We are Brightside Home Theater.
Just ran into the same issue, and that's why I texted you or I emailed you and said I'll be jumping on in about 15 minutes. That's what happened with Steve at the beginning of that show yesterday. Is that right. we normally knew our time change, our time difference, but we over here had just set our clocks ahead an hour on Saturday.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if you heard that in the live stream or not. And that's why I've been sitting
there
working.
You probably did that right at the start. I missed start of the live stream. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. If I'd caught that, I might have been a bit more on it.
No. And that's why, but it wasn't a big deal. I didn't want to stress you out. I'm like, I know you were like, I had said we had planned this a little while ago about coming on at noon my time. Mm. And then last night I was like, oh, should I email Paul, let him know. I'm like, no, I'll just email him right before. And if you're an hour behind, no big deal, because I'm sitting here working anyways.
Okay.
I'm working on HT Tours stuff right now, and I'm trying to finish up the editing on one. I got to record another one later today. So I'm getting both of those ready. So I'm just sitting here doing all of that. And it's like, whenever you could jump on, I just saw you, like I had you in an open window in the top corner of my screen. And I was like, oh, there he is. Okay. There we go.
Okay.
So yeah, it all worked.
I saw your splash screen of your theater and your seats and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I just thought, is that where he podcasts from? Cause he's obviously gone off to do something. He's those seats are empty. I'm like, he's gone shopping. he's kind of taking the dog for a walk because I'm so late.
Yeah. No, not late at all. I figured this was going to happen. It's not a problem at all. I really appreciate it. But Paul, you're the next British person.
Apparently so.
On my show. It's like, Steve's not the only one. He's not so special anymore.
there's some competition for him, but I only found you. I found you because of Steve.
Yeah.
And I found Steve on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what we were talking about, but we had a little kind of exchange about his cinema, my cinema, and projectors versus televisions.
Yes.
And because I'm kind of a projector guy, even though it's not up.
Right.
And he's like, oh no, I've got my Z9. It's great. And I'm like, oh, is that really big enough though? Is it really a cinema? If it's a, I can't remember how big is his screen? Is it eight? It's something like 85 though, isn't it?
He's got a big screen. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good size screen, and he sits pretty close to it too. So
okay. Yeah.
He's getting a real good image. So
yeah.
I mean, he's getting a real good experience, I should say.
Sure.
You know.
So he and I were chatting, and then he showed me his amazing disc collection, his amazing Anonymous. What the heck is that? It's fantastic. Yeah. I've come around to it. Initially I was, oh no, 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 no. And then since then I've been thinking, you can see I need some more shelves behind me.
Yeah.
And Steve buys everything, doesn't he? He literally, that's out this week. I'll buy that.
Yeah.
And I'm quite selective about what I want to actually have on disc. And I always have been, because it just gets out of hand. You know, you could own everything, never watch it, and then fill your house up with it. And I mean, over the years I have done, but it's, you know, my DVD collection's upstairs, and it's, you know, so I don't know what to do with that.
I know. I'm the same way. I've tried selling some of it off. I've tried selling some of my Blu-rays off back a while ago. My laser discs, I still have, and I love them. I love saying that I have them still, because it was a big part. That was a huge part of my life. That was the first time in my life, that first time in my home theater journey anyways, that I was like, wow, I have the ultimate. You know, and that was a big deal, because back then it was like that, you know, Laserdisc was more, I would say Laserdisc might have been more rare than Kaleidoscape is today. I think.
Do you think? Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because certainly it was here. I mean, it was very niche here, you know. Yeah. And there was a number of small, like sort of home cinema, home theater stores that sold the hardware. And as you were walking out, you could pick up a copy of Speed or whatever on Laserdisc. Mm. And then there was a few record shops sold them, but it was, you know, people would, you'd go to the checkout with a Laserdisc and the girl behind the checkout would go, "What the hell is this you're buying? Yeah. It's a movie, but it looks like an L, but it's the size of an L. What is it?" It's like, you sell it. You know,
it's in your store.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was so weird. So and it was expensive, but not as it, but Kaleidoscape. I know the software, the movies are about the same price as UHD DVD, Blu-ray, aren't they?
I would say on average they're slightly cheaper.
Okay.
Because like some of the movies, very few have I paid over $30. Right. Most of them are, I would say, around 24. Okay.
Okay.
But then a lot of them, quite a few, you can get on sale. You get them for $9.99 on sale. They'll run specials and stuff like that. So I find it that, but you could say the same thing about 4Ks. But see, where I would say, like, John always tries to get his on sale. But I would say the average price for a 4K release on disc would be around like the $30 mark. That's when they first get released. That's what they cost, right? I'm finding that on Kaleidoscape, it's very rare that I'll see something over $30. Most of the time, it's around the $24.99 mark. And in only time that I've paid over $30 is when I'm buying it like before it's even out yet. You know, it's a pre-sale type thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I think it. I mean, but it's not like, you know, it sounds foolish when you're talking about the, you know, oh, I'm saving money on it.
Because
the hardware itself gets you in, you know, costs a lot to get into it. So,
yeah. But yeah, that's when you were talking about it last night. And I hadn't, you know, I don't know how much penetration Kaleidoscape has had in the UK. I get the impression close to zero.
It has some, because every time Steve mentions it, people say like, oh, it's over there. Like I'll get, we get comments from people saying, oh, you can find it over here somewhere. You know, it's there. Steve hasn't really pursued it is he just has no way to hook it up in his theater. He has no internet in the theater.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So he can't, and you can't really utilize Wi-Fi for that. So he just doesn't feel the need. And the other part is he has so many discs. He's like, do I start again?
My God, if he took his disc collection and did that thing of where it doesn't rip it, but it recognizes it and goes, oh, in that case, you can have it for $5.
Exactly.
Great. Except he has like 1,000.
Yeah, you know, but he could really do that. Like I'm thinking of getting my Blu-rays down because I've boxed up all my Blu-rays. I only display my 4K discs now, but I've boxed up all my Blu-rays and put them upstairs. I'm actually going to unbox and one by one and put them into the Kaleidoscape, because even if I already have it, some of them might already be in there, some of them might not even be a price break, but the majority of them would be, and you would just, it would just change everything for you, and you go right. But I'm kind of waiting on that until I can hopefully get the next hard drive, the larger, because I got no more space. So
that's
like, going to
be the
I
next
doing?
Thing, isn't it? You know,
yeah,
it's sort of
that's the next extra piece. Yes,
yeah. Oh God, but yeah, it's just that the cost of the Kaleidoscape hardware is I mean, it's so huge. I mean, you mentioned that to most people over here, and they go, "You spent what? You spent how much on a thing that plays movies? Yeah. What's wrong with DVD? You know?" And so
And I get it, believe me, I do. Yeah. And it's like, and it's, I can't stress enough to people. I try to, and it's so funny. It's like, I try to explain to people, you don't need it. And you, I would never want to recommend this to anybody. I don't recommend it to anybody, honestly. I'm like, because it's a very, for me, the people in my world, it's not something that's easily affordable, right? If you have the disposable income and it's easily affordable, then absolutely, it's the best possible thing, right? If it's not if the money's not the issue, why would you get a DVD player? I would just get this because it's just much more practical, right? Because money's not an issue. Where money's an issue, I'd need to know why you want this, because I might talk you out of it. If you're thinking one thing, I might be able to say to you, like, you're not going to get much more out of this than that, you know, something like that. So it is expensive. It is, like I've said on the podcast before, my son's like, he doesn't really see the difference between the Zapedi and the Kaleidoscape, because he's like, it works the same to me. Well, I mean, the Kaleidoscape's a little faster even for him, but he's like, that's not really worth the money. But he didn't see all the work I did on the Zapedi to get it to work that way, right? Yeah. And that's where the value comes in, right?
Yeah.
And, you know,
I think we've all had those times, haven't we? When you just go, hey, so I could move my whole collection, all my videotapes or my DV tapes, and I could get them onto this. And then if I had them, it'd be a lot easier to access. Because I went through that when recordable DVD came out.
Yeah.
And I've got acres and acres of VHS things that I, you know, wanted to hang on to, and DV tapes, which, you know, DV, the little DV tape.
Digital video tapes. Yep.
Yeah. And you just think to yourself, hey, now we've got this recordable DVD. I could just store everything on DVD. That'd be fine, wouldn't it? That'd be great. And I could author them, and they could have like chapters and different, and have like a menu. I have a menu so I can find everything instead of having to wind through the tape to this. But I can just literally go to the program I want. And great idea. I must have made about 8 DVD-Rs before I just went, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to spend the rest of my life doing this.
I know.
You know, whereas, as you say, with Kaleidoscape, I want that movie, got that movie, download. How long does it take to download a
10 minutes.
10 minutes, right. Okay, on a fast connection. You know, 10 minutes, go make a cup of tea and, and play with the dog for a bit, come back, you've got the movie and all the menus and the, you know, where there's a PT, I mean, it would take you about 2 days just to get the, I'm sure it's great. And as you know, I actually do want a Zapiti, but not for ripping. I'm not going to start ripping my movie collection there, but it's perfectly happy on disc. I can put a disc in the machine and press play and it works. I haven't got enough other stuff to do. I think we all have, haven't we?
Oh yeah.
You know,
I love to tinker. That's why I didn't mind my Zapedi adventure. I was pulling my hair out at times early on. It was I am not as computer oriented as some of my listeners that were great, that helped me out. A few Zapedi owners helped me out, and a few computer people helped me out. IT people. I have Joe, my IT guy now, because of that. It's like, he really helped me out a lot. And I had him on speed dial, like, Joe, what's the problem here? And it's fun. This is the Zapedi thing for me. Which was funny is, I didn't even understand the language, and I know computer. I've built computers before. I've done a lot of stuff with computers, but just never, like, I hadn't done a lot in the last, say, 15 years. Like, I built a computer, and then my first computer I built myself. I bought all the components. I put everything together. And this was back in like Windows, before Windows 95 or whatever. So I did all of that. And
Windows 3.1.
Yeah, it's just all the
but
I'd forgotten more than I could ever remember now, you know. And so when it came time to do all this stuff, I was like, okay, so I need to buy a hard drive. I did this, and I would literally stand in this area I am in right now, where my computer is, and I had an external hard drive with an external it was actually an internal hard drive. It was a 16 terabyte hard drive that had an external loading dock. And I was into my computer. I'd pop that out, bring it over, and I'd put that hard drive into the Zapedi, fire up the Zapedi, do all this stuff. I did that for 2.5-3 months.
Yeah.
And then Joe's like, you calling it, and he goes, you're doing this, what does he call it? Sneaker net, he called it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The internet. Where you
pick a drive up and,
and you carry it over there. And he goes,
yep.
You know, you can, and he just, in like,
just run underneath
I that want cable. To say 5 minutes. It was like 5 seconds. He's like, you could just hear the keyboard go, he goes, you can just connect your Zapedi right to your computer. I'm like, no, you can't. You got to do it. And he goes, no. Your Zapedi's on your network. And he walked me through it over the phone. He goes, do this. There it is. Boom. I was like, are you crap? Are you kidding me? I can just.
What have I been doing for the last 2 weeks?
I'm like, but light shines on yonder rock. And I'm like, my head. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And I was like, oh. So that's how I learn. I have to learn by making the mistake. Because if I don't. You could tell me that all day long, and I'd be like, yeah, okay, I don't understand what that means. Until I see it in executed, then I understand it, right? So it's like, let me screw everything up, and then I'll fix it, and then I'll know why everything works the way it does. Yeah. So I learned a ton that way. And with Joe and Nelson and other people with the it was great. Those were the two main ones. But I loved it, and I still love it, and I'm glad I have it, because I still load any disc I get. I load right onto the Zapedi, and it'll be there. I'm not taking it with me. My son will have it, and and then when I leave, it'll just be all Kaleidoscape and a player. So
yeah, I can't believe how my little sort of rack of gear is sitting in the, because I am technically in my home cinema at the moment.
Oh, okay.
May not look like it, because everything seems a shade of beige behind
me. It's not home cinema colors. That's office colors. It's very warm and inviting. Not that home cinemas aren't.
It's a long story. So
we got time. I'm not recording another show for another 3 hours.
Yeah, so I got 27 minutes. Yeah. And then I got to run.
Not that much of a rush, but yeah, I do have to get up to another show today. But
okay. Golly, I'm so busy. Amazing. Okay. So I'm going to hop around here a bit. So at the moment, my life seems to be taken up with where the hell do I live? That seems to have been my life for the last 5 years, really.
Really?
So we're on the outskirts of London here.
Okay.
So this is like suburban South London. And it's not really where I intended to live, but it's where I've ended up. So I had a flat in London on the Tube network. Great. And because of work, I sort of outgrew it. I sort of ran out of space. It was a top floor flat. And because I work in sound, in audio and live recording. And so I'm sort of carrying equipment in and out my little flat all the time. Mm. And gradually the equipment's getting bigger and heavier. And I'm struggling up this flight of stairs. And, because I've been mixing recordings late at night, I've got neighbors on 2-3 sides of me to worry about. So my parents went, your grandparents' old house is still available, which is where I am now. You could always mix there. And it's only semi-detached here, so there's only one neighbor. Okay. And so I moved a load of my mixing equipment here, and I started mixing in this house. So I'd leave my flat, because it's only like 6-7 miles apart from that part of South London.
Okay.
So if I needed a mix, I'd jump in the car, drive over here, come and mix. And then I could mix late and I could make as much noise as I like within reason, and everything was fine. And then one day, the obvious happened. What a bunch of idiots. It got broken into, didn't it? Because there was no one living here, and I had all my mix equipment stolen. And I just thought to myself, I'm being an idiot, aren't I? What the heck? And so it just became apparent that I was going to have to move out my flat and come and live here. I couldn't leave equipment here and not live here. It was insane. Luckily, I didn't lose too much that I was too worried about. I was planning on changing loads of gear anyway. So, you know, it was a couple of things. There were some pieces of equipment I'd actually built, I'd designed and built, that got stolen, which was a bit sad. So I basically moved here and let my flat in London. And the whole time I was here, I was going, you know, I'm going to have to buy a house in London. I'm going to have to sell my flat and see if I can buy a house somewhere. There's a bit more space, a bit more practical, ground floor. Mm. And that was around, 2008. So it was quite a while ago. And of course, around 2008, we had the big dot-com crash. And property prices in London like halved. And I'm like, wow, you know, now's the time to buy. If you're going to have to buy something, now is the time to buy something. And I then spent the next 5-6 years looking for somewhere to buy. Just because things would come up and you wouldn't get them and then you couldn't afford them or you missed out on them because you were too busy with work or whatever. Mm. And so I'm still here. I have found somewhere and it's fantastic. And it's still South London, but like halfway into central London from where I am now. So it'll be perfect. The only problem is I've got to build it because it's basically a piece of land.
That you're in my world, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So whenever I hear you, you know, your conversations about your house build. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in exactly the same boat. And so.
Now, does that bother you or does that excite you?
Oh, what? Building a house?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's incredibly exciting. It's absolutely brilliant. I cannot wait. And, it, you know, the whole house exists in my head. So what happened was basically I spent 2 years trying to buy a house in this place called Crystal Palace. You might have heard of the football team. There's a football team called Crystal Palace.
Okay.
Or a London team.
Yeah, part of it.
They're nearby. But Crystal Palace had became a really nice place to live. Suddenly it got a train line and you know. So it
that helps. Became, same over here. You get a train into the town, it's like property values go up because trains go to where people are and that's what exactly. So people get to leave the crowded area and go to that place where the train is.
But it was far enough out of central London to actually be affordable. And, of course, people hadn't thought about it because it's not technically on the tube network. It's not on the subway. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of Londoners are like, well, if it's not on the tube, I'm not going there. You know, they don't own cars. You know, no one in central London really owns a car. You can get everywhere on the tube network, just like New York City. But if it's not, if it's sort of, if your house of where you live isn't on the subway, no one goes there. You know, it's like, oh, I'm not going. In fact, there are Londoners who are going, well, I don't go south of the river. There's a whole, I don't know if you know, but in London, there's a whole north versus south thing. And all the north Londoners think that they're, you know, they're it.
We get that over here too.
Yeah.
It's the same. I live out here. So you have Boston, which, you know, is like, it's on the water, right? Seashore. So you have Boston, and then you'd have what we call like 128. It's a highway section that kind of cuts through. It goes around Boston probably like 5 miles out. Okay. In like almost a circle around Boston, 5 to 7 miles out. Then you have 495. It's another highway. It goes actually in the same kind of circle. Like if you took a compass and you drew these little circles, and this one's about 20 miles out. I live about 10 miles past that, right? The people in Boston, it's not on, like, they would think anything outside of 495, you might as well be on the West Coast.
Right.
It's there's Boston, there's 495 and Los Angeles. Because they never leave the city. They never get out of the city. They're like, ooh, trees. It's amazing to me that I like the other way. I love living out in the trees and then I travel to visit the concrete.
Right. Yes. Yeah. When you have to.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I've ended up being the same. I mean, as soon as you get off the tube network in London, you, funnily enough, you tend not to use it quite as much because it's not as available. And so suddenly you sort of, you just get used to the idea of I'm here, it's there, I can go and visit it when I need to, but I, you know, I'm quite happy where I am. And as you say, property is cheaper, you know, there are more trees, which is important with the dog.
You know, you got a dog too? Nice.
I have, yeah. As we mentioned last night, because there was a dog in the
oh, was that yeah. Oh, that was you.
Ad?
Okay, yeah.
That was the Glidescape ad, wasn't it? And they cut to the family.
Yeah, and the family sitting with the
Black and white husky.
Yeah.
Black and white husky sat on the sofa with them. And my reaction was, what are you doing on the sofa? The sofa.
Yeah, I know. Well, so you have a husky?
I do.
That's what I have. Yeah.
Yes.
I have the redheaded husky.
Yeah.
And they call them redheaded. They're brown, but they call them redheaded. And when we got her, my wife, same thing. She's like, oh, don't let her. And we got her as a little tiny puppy, a little puff ball, right? Aww. And she was trying to get up onto the sofa and she, her little paws, and she couldn't get up there. And I help her up. And my wife's like, we're not going to let her on the sofa. I was like, we've never said no to the dogs. And we had just lost our shepherd like a month and a half earlier, 2 months earlier. And she was always on the sofa. We used to invite her, but she just didn't like it. She was big. She was like 70 pound shepherd. Yeah, she was a big girl. She was great, great dog. She used to mountain bike with me, run with me, trail run. She'd go swimming. I'd go for a 2 mile swim and she would try to go with me. I'd go kayaking and she would try to swim along with me when we had a place up in Maine. She followed me everywhere. She was an awesome dog. But yeah, so when we get this husky, I was like, it's hair. We're going to deal with it. So we're just constantly cleaning hair off the couches. You got the, so do you allow your husky on the, no, not at
all. Well, he's not, funnily enough, he's not really interested in the sofa. He's sat on the sofa maybe half a dozen times and he sits there for about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then just goes, oh, I don't see the point. What am I doing up here? and he hops off. He doesn't want to sit with me. He's you know, he's a fantastic dog, but he's not like any other dog we've ever had.
Does he like to talk?
He does a bit. He's become a bit more talkative. He's quite actually. He's now eight and a half.
Oh wow! So is mine.
And he's and he's a rescue. So he's a sort of ex street dog. So when you take him for a walk, you'll generally find him digging through bins and things, or eating a dead pigeon. That's one of his favorite things. So he's like a lot of huskies. He's quite sort of independent, but he's every now and then. And then late in the evening, he'll wander over and like, does yours do this? Comes and sits right next to you with his back to you. And that's code for, I need a cuddle. I need a hug.
I just learned what that means, so my husky will come over and she doesn't like to have her back touched. She, even as a puppy, and we adopted her as a puppy, there's a husky breeder that is like 3 miles from my house. So we went and it was like buying a car. What do you want? And it was, you know, what kind of dog do you want? Do you want a black and white female? Do you want power windows? You know, what do you want with this thing? And she'll breed it for you right there. And we just fell in love with her. She was there. She was ready. And she was like 3 weeks out, 4 weeks out. So we saw her at about 4 weeks old, 3 weeks old. And we got her at 7 weeks old. So she let us take her a week early. But yeah, we just fell in love with her and we're like, all right. So, but she comes up and she doesn't, like you said, huskies, I definitely want another one someday. They're the most amazing dog, as a breed, because they are, like you said, independent, but they're not loners. They're independent, but they need to be around you 24/7. Right. So it sounds weird because we have a little dog who's like a little Yorkie terrier type thing, and he's a little cuddle bug and he burrows and everything. And when we had a kennel for him, a little crate for him, we'd say time for bed and he'd run right in, fall asleep, put the blanket over it, and he was good for the night. So we got a big kennel, big crate for Romy, the husky, put her in it as a puppy. She cried and cried and cried. We brought the crate up to our bedroom, put it in our bedroom. She was okay. Fine. I'll go to bed. And she, as long as she's in the room with you, she was fine. But she'll jump up on the couch with me. Like you said, like yours will come and sit next to you and put their back to you. She jumps up on the couch and she will lay down, put her head on my lap and fall asleep. Oh. But if I pet her, she'll look at me. And then if I like, I'll get to like, if I pet her and I rub her neck or something, she'll be like, okay, but then she'll get down. Like, okay, you took it too far. If I don't touch her, she'll sleep there for like an hour. No problem. But if as soon as I start touching her, she's like, no, I don't like to. Okay. But
it's crazy, isn't it? It's sort of, you know, huskies are all alike and then they're all completely different from each other as well at the same time. You know, it's kind of, I don't understand.
They're a great breed.
Mine. Yeah. Hard work. But
that great. Back thing, though, that we.
Yeah. So,
My youngest dog, who we got as a rescue, he was really temperamental, and we sent him away to a boarding training for 2 weeks, got him back. He's amazing now. He's just, he follows me anywhere. I take him to the store and he just stays right on me. Everybody's like, oh my God, he's amazing. Yeah, he is. But very, very anxious. And the trainer said that their backs are, that's why they'll back up against you. That's their most vulnerable spot. So there's two times when the dog's vulnerable. Anything behind them, they get scared. Mm-hmm. And of course, when they're pooping, because they're in their most vulnerable position and they can't protect themselves. And so you'll see, like, when she backs up, when your dog backs up against you, he's just like, okay, I want to be protected. I want to be loved, but he'll just back his back up against you. And that shows he trusts you too.
Okay. I'm glad it's a good thing.
It is a great thing.
I thought it was great. It's actually a really bad sign. Yeah. It means they can't stand you.
Yeah.
Turn their back on you.
The other thing the trainer told me was, we all think of dogs as our protectors, right? Dogs think of us as their protectors. So if you're the owner, and she's trained police dogs, she's like, even police dogs, they're doing what they can to protect their protector.
Okay.
And they expect the same in return. So when your dog backs up, if you're in public and you see your dog backing up against your leg, it wants protection. It's looking for you. It's coming to you for safety. And and you have to be that. And that's what she said. Like, when I take my littlest dog out in public, he gets very skittish. Like, he'll follow me all over the store. As soon as we get in line to check out, he gets nervous because now we're standing still and he starts looking around. His back is right in against me. He gets upset. It's sad because he was a rescue too. He was a puppy on the street and we don't know what happened to him. I feel awful, but we got him at 8 weeks. So his first 8 weeks of life must've been brutal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm amazed how mine's called Mika. I'm amazed how he's sort of adapted because, you know, he was slightly out of control when I first got him. And the whole time you're thinking, am I going to be able to deal with this? You know, is this going to destroy my life for the next 10 years? And no, he's just become sort of more and more sort of dependable and loyal and he's so good with other dogs and other people and, you know, particularly if they've got food. But I was trying to remember how we got onto dogs. I mean, it's going to happen when you get two husky people together.
Oh, yeah.
It's inevitable.
Like, welcome to Brightside Husky Podcast.
we should start another podcast.
Yeah, just what
get
I mean.
Husky owners on for like half an hour at a time.
Yeah, exactly.
Does
yours watch movies with you? Have you seen when I tweet that stuff out?
Yeah, no, that she is actually a problem. You're very lucky, actually. Yeah, no, mine... It's the first, because this is about the fourth dog we've had. But he is the only dog who doesn't watch television that we've ever had. So it doesn't matter what you put on. With the other dogs, we've always been able to put on, like, Discovery, whatever it's called, Discovery Wildlife kind of thing. And they'll sit there for an hour and watch leopards and cheetahs and birds and whales and things. He doesn't even know the television is a thing. He can't, it just doesn't register. You know, there'll be another dog on TV and you go, hey, Mika, look. And he's looking at your finger and wondering where the food is. And so if I'm trying to watch a movie, that's actually one of the most irritating things for him. Because he's like, well, you're just leaving me alone now.
Right.
You know, you're just, I don't know what it is you're doing, but you're sitting there in some noisy room in the dark. And what on earth are you doing? And so he'll come in. That's a real problem. He'll come in like every 10 minutes for the first three quarters of an hour of a film. He'll wander in and sort of smack me on the foot and want to go out or want a treat or want to. So, yeah, it's a bit of a challenge. There have been times I've thought about taking him over to my mum's for the evening when I wanted to watch a film, just so I can watch it uninterrupted. But
yeah,
so it'd be great if he could watch movies, if he just sit. Or he doesn't even have to watch them. Just come and lie on your bed in the lounge and keep quiet, and that'll be fine. But no, it's yeah, you know, that you can do all the treatments and all the bias lighting and paint your room black and make it into as much of a sort of home theater as you like. But I haven't been in a cinema yet where a dog comes in and bugs you every 10 minutes. So that is a little bit of an issue, but
you don't want that, but you'll take it. Exactly. We love our dogs. Mm. Absolutely. A lot of sacrifices for our dogs.
Yeah. It's, so trying to get back to the housing situation. So I'm living in my grandparents' old house temporarily, surrounded by all my equipment for work. And there's another story there, which may not even get onto. And in the meantime, I found a house in Crystal Palace. Fantastic house, needed a ton of work doing. And obviously, when I'm looking for houses, I'm looking for somewhere that I can build a studio. Because this is, you know, that was the problem with the flat. You couldn't, you know, you could do bits and pieces of audio work, but you couldn't mix there. You couldn't spend 3 days with a band recording drums in your flat. And it was, you know, work-wise, it was becoming a bit of an issue not having a studio, not having a space I could work in. So I'm looking for a house that I can build an audio studio in. Mm. And that kind of limits your options. It means it basically has to be detached if it's going to be in the house. Or it has to have an enormous garden where you can build a studio down the end of the garden. And houses in London don't have enormous gardens, so that's pretty much out. So then you're looking for a detached house in London. I mean, even in 2008, they weren't cheap. But of course, I didn't manage to find anything in 2008. And sort of over the next 4 years, they doubled in price again. And so you're talking $1.5 million or anything like that. So I found this rundown house in Crystal Palace, which is a little bit cheaper. And the house looked like a miniature version of Abbey Road. It was just, you looked at it from the outside and you just went, well, that just, it wants to be a recording studio, doesn't it? Look at it.
Yeah.
It's halfway there already.
Jeez.
And I spent 2 years trying to buy it. And in that 2 years, it was originally on the market at £700,000, which, believe me, was cheap, very cheap. And so I made an offer. It was accepted. Great. We're going ahead. And then I got a price for doing it up because it needed so much work. And would have needed a lot of work done in the basement because it had a basement where I was going to put the studio. And it would have had to be underpinned and we'd need to go down about another 4 feet and all this kind of stuff. But it was all manageable and that was going to be the big project. And then they went, oh, no, we're not going to sell it to you after all. You know, literally the day we were going to exchange. And then they came back and said, oh, we want 900,000 for it now. And I'm like, that's, you know, plus the 200,000 I'm going to have to spend doing the place up. That's getting difficult.
I looked around
and I just went, well, what else am I ever going to find that's anything like this or for anything like that money? So I made them another offer and they accepted it. And I'm like, okay, so look, I'm now paying £200,000 more than I was originally planning to pay, but at least we're getting somewhere.
Right.
And then they took it off the market again and said, oh, no, we've decided we're not going to, you know, and then they changed agents.
So
And they put it back on at £1.2 million. So in the space of 2 years, it went up from 700,000 to 1.2 million. And it still was a wreck on the inside. It still needed £250,000 spending on doing it up. And so basically, I was just like, what am I going to do? I've spent 2 years looking for a house and thought I'd found the house. And now I've got nothing. And I'm still in my grandparents' old house.
Yeah.
Sort of miles out of town. My life is falling apart. And then I found another house in Crystal Palace, much smaller, but basically needed demolishing. And I'm like, well, you know, if I was going to spend £250,000 fixing up some old house, why not just start from scratch? It would actually be easier.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, boy, did I really say that to myself? It'll actually be easier. To build a new house? Stupid. Really stupid. So I then went through five architects trying to find someone that would design what I wanted.
And what was the issue? How, like, what are different architects doing?
Well, they all just wanted to do things their way. So there I am saying, I need a basement. The basement will be the studio. It'll be detached, and, you know, and it's an awkward shaped plot, and, you know, so there's a limit to what you can build on it because it's really tight, small plot. But this is what I want. And they go, oh, you should build it out of cross-laminated timber, which is like a solid wood walls, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I don't really want that. Oh, you really should. You should consider fantastic cross-laminated, wonderful material. I'm like, I'm sure it is, but I don't want the inside of my house to look like a sauna, you know? and so how much is it going to cost anyway? And they said, oh, about £1 million. That costs about £1 million to build. I'm like, I'm not that successful, mate, you know. And other people just wanted to build a box, all the best things, just build a square box with a roof on it. And I'm like, yeah, but the plot is like a wedge shape. So you build a square box on a wedge shaped plot. It's going to be tiny. Oh, well, that's the bit. And I just went through architects. And over the year and a half, I was trying to find an architect. I'd pretty much designed it myself. And that's so, nice. At which point I'm going up to architects and saying, well, this is the kind of thing I'm thinking of building. And we have this basement, it'd be like this. And here's a 3D render of what I'm planning on building. Right. And they went, well, why don't you just put those plans into the planning? Because that looks fine.
Right.
And so in the end, I went, oh, well, all right, I will. So now I'm the architect.
Yeah.
Which is insane because I'm not an architect.
No.
I've never built a house, I've never designed a house. But I have now. And so it's mad. I wish I could show you the pictures. I can show the pictures on my phone. But it's going to be great. So, but the basement is the recording studio. And believe me, I've thought so much about putting the home cinema in the basement.
You know, because that is not. Kind of you need to have a recording studio. So,
yeah, like most of us. I need to have a recording studio. Don't we all need a recording studio?
So what do you record? What you do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I work mainly in television and TV sound. So I started out as a musician and I was always the guy that did all the recording. And this is actually going to link to the whole home cinema thing as well. Cause I kind of inherited all this from my dad because my dad was a hi-fi nut. And a photography nut. And he was just into all that, kind of like us, into all the gadgets, the technology of the time. And you know, he'd have a massive pair of speakers delivered and my mum would go nuts, you know. It's like, what are you doing spending money on all these speakers? And there'd be me going, hey, wow, cool, new speakers. And, you know, when I'm like 8 years old.
Right. And, with no concept of the money. Like, why is mum upset? These are great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, these are fantastic. And so I got the bug for recording and audio and all that kind of things. And also I played a lot of music, and I played piano, and I played drums, and I was in bands, and, you know, and so it was obvious I was always going to do stuff like that. But because my dad, because the other thing my dad was into was obviously tape recorders, you know, like analog tape machines. And, so when I say he was into them, he owned about four. When, you know, in the mid 70s, he owned about four different quarter inch reel to reel machines. Wow. So, and he couldn't use four at once. So he gave me the oldest one when I was five. And so I was the guy there with my little Grundig reel to reel recording Top of the Pops off the TV with a little microphone and playing it back and playing things, turning the tape over and playing things backwards and speeding things up, wow, slowing them down, and just, the only thing I can remember being a little kid. I mean, literally, it's one of my earliest memories was getting having this little Grundig tape recorder with its little 7-inch reels, and, but not having the manual dexterity to deal with when the tape got tangled, you know, when you're just lacing it through the rollers and the arms and stuff. And then you get the tape sort of wrapped over on itself, and your dad, I can't get it to work. And he'd have to come and like untangle it all for you. And, oh, great, working, you know. And so recording was it, and music and bands and all of that. So I'm like in bands, but I'm also recording bands. And so for years, I mean, my dad was always trying to, I think he was always trying to convince me to open a recording studio. And I back in the '80s, and I just used to say, you know, it's a mug's game. It's, I'd love to, I would love nothing more, but it is one giant money pit. You know, you'll never make any money. All you'll do is spend money. And so I didn't, but I actually ended up in like graphic design, and because I was not really making any money as a drummer, and I wanted to get out of the house. And then at some point I just went, you know, I'm in all these bands and I'm always recording these bands, but it's really hard to record live shows. Really hard. You know, it's like, you know, particularly on a small, but all this kind of digital technology has come along, hard disk recording. There is a way it could be done. There's a way it could be done, and the equipment would be small enough and compact enough. And I reckon we could do it. So I spent all of my savings on a load of recording gear to record bands live. And I was broke for 5 years and couldn't get a job. And then just as I'm thinking, what have I done? Because by this stage, I'm in my 40s. And I'm just thinking, oh, really, I'm in really big trouble now. And my girlfriend's like, why have you never got any money? You know, it's so short of money. And then suddenly I started getting some television work. And there was a TV show that was where they needed someone to record bands. It was like you don't have, what do you, what's the name of the big talent show you have? American Idol.
American Idol, which we took from you guys, didn't we?
Yeah, you took it from Pop Idol we had, and then we turned into X Factor. And so there's all these, the whole talent. Well, a talent show for bands, a televised American Idol style thing came up, but for whole bands on Channel 4. And they needed someone to record, to multi-track all these bands live. And somehow they found my website and they said, oh, could you do it? And I went, yeah, sure. Thinking, okay, I haven't really worked in television before, but I bluffed it. And
fake it till you make it.
absolutely that. We did 2 years, two seasons of that. And then I went on to recording festivals and a lot of live music for MTV and for Channel 4. And, that's what I was doing. Gone really well for the last 15 years, basically. That's what I've been doing for 20. Actually, last year was my 20th anniversary of doing. I started in 2002. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So 20 years of being out hauling equipment around, So if I could swing the camera around, you discover that just off to the side of the stage, either side of your view, there's flight cases and mixers and, you know, all kinds of crap all over the room. It's actually a long story. Anyway, so that's what I do, and that's why I need a studio. I after 20 years, not quite so keen on chasing all over the world with flight cases full of equipment, and, you know, I feel like I want to be a bit more home-based, and so I'm doing the thing I said I would never do, which is open a recording studio. Bad idea, really bad idea, but I'm doing it anyway. So that'll be in the basement. But in terms of home cinema, home theater, it's gonna have to be the dual purpose lounge come, you know, living room come home cinema thing.
Okay.
But believe me, I've designed it. It's, you know, if when you're architecting your own house, as you know, you are going to design your home cinema. So yeah, the 3D render, when you do, you see, you're working in this architecture software and you do a little 3D render of the interior, you can see where the 77 inch OLED and the left center and right are going, because they're there. They're in the render of the, yeah. So it's all worked out.
So I haven't done the 3D render yet.
No.
I've done everything. I've hand drawn everything on graph paper, and then I import it into, I go, same thing. You're probably going to be just like Joe, my IT guy, and you're going to be like, oh, you could do this. I actually, because that's growing up, that's what my dad did. When we had a split level ranch, and when they bought the house, they could only afford the main floor to be done, and the whole basement, it's meant to be finished, because you come in the front door and you can either go upstairs or downstairs. It's split level. And we did the basement over probably 5 years, 6-8 years after we moved in, and my dad designed the whole basement. He measured everything out, and a foot, each piece of, you know, each square on the graph would be a foot, right? So you do that, and he got his compass out, and he'd make the swing for the doors, the 3-3 foot doorways and all that. I mean, designed the whole thing. And I remember as a little kid just sitting there watching him do this and being like, oh, you know, he's like, when he was in the military, they sent them to drafting school or whatever. And so he's like, this is how you do this. I took drafting when I was in high school. So now it comes time for my house, and I had ideas. So I'm designing, then we get an architect, and I need the architect for like all the codes and everything that are required. But my latest house, the one we're doing, is, you know, I did it, and I gave it to him, much like you. And like, what do you need me for? Well, I need you for the codes, and he knows. Yeah. But I've imported all that into my computer, put it in, I went into Adobe Photoshop, and I'd pull out the everything, and I'd actually render it, but I did a lot more work for that. But is there a program for me to, like, I can put this thing in, scan something in, and do a 3D render of it too?
Well, a lot of people do quite a bit of architecture stuff in just SketchUp, in Google SketchUp, which I'm not an expert on at all, but yeah, you could certainly do it that way. I taught myself a package called Revit, which is made by Autodesk. So the people that make AutoCAD, they have a specifically architecture, and it's a BIM package, a building information management system. So it's specifically designed at buildings and architecture.
Yeah.
And yeah, if you lay out all the walls and the floors, and you get your levels, and you design your roof, and it's basically 3D software. So you're, most of the time, you're sitting there in plan, as you say, in like 2D mode, where you're just doing the floor plan. Yeah. But then you can step back and effectively get a camera and look at your building from, you know, place the camera wherever you want and take a look at how it looks from the outside, from the inside, what the outside looks like from the inside. So you can put your camera inside and look out of the window and see what the garden looks like from the lounge. In my case, I had to model the neighbors as well. So not only do, yeah, because the planners right. want to see how it's going to sit in right. context with the people either side. And on one side of me, I've got a very complicated, large Victorian property, which took ages to model. But now I've got a view of the whole street. I can look at my house in context of the whole street, and it's, you know, and go, is that going to be all right? Yeah. I would not advise anyone who's not an architect to do their own architecting. having now done it, if you actually want a house to live in, get someone else to design it and build it. Because I started doing all this in 2016, and I've literally only just put the plans in, like,
wow,
2 weeks ago. It's taken
that
long. I
hope that doesn't happen to me.
Oh, well, how far along are you with? Out of the ground already, aren't you?
No,
aren't you?
I'm in the process. Like, so what I have to do over here, especially in my situation, is I have to, I need to purchase the land, but to do that, I'm doing a construction. What we have over here is a construction loan. Okay. Mm. So the bank, basically, to do that, you need to own 40% of the land, plus you have to have 20%. You have to pay 20% of the entire project. Okay.
You have to commit to.
I have the funds for 20% of the project.
Yeah.
Okay. So the day we close, I have to ship one. I have to have 40%. So I put 40% of the land up, and then I have to have the funds, like you said, 20% of the project, and then they will start paying for the rest of the project as we go. And now that's when we close on the land. It's like literally the next day I'm like, okay, building permits, get this stuff done. And then they just start laying out then the bank starts laying out the money. Plus I have money to front that to get, and then the foundation goes in and stuff like that. But to do all of that, I have to get the bank wants a approved septic design.
Right. Yeah.
So to have a septic, because I have everything's on property. We don't have sewer in this area that the house is in. So everything's on property. So I'll have my own well. I'll have my own septic design, which is what I have here at this house too. Mm-hmm. Personally, I like that. It's like, it just keeps it everything I'm self-contained. Mm-hmm. But the problem with this piece of land, there's some wetlands on it that don't affect where my house is going to be, but I have to cross this like 3-foot stream to get onto my property. Between the road and my property, there's a 3-foot stream. And anytime you do that over here, the conservation's like, well, you know, we might find that, you know, 3-webbed frog, and we got to make sure that it has a good living place or whatever. Right. So you got to cross over that. They have to approve it. That takes a little bit of time. So I'm about a month, 6 weeks away from all of that being done. Once that's done, it's like literally next day we close, boom, boom, done. And then I can start building. Wow. So,
wow. Do you, you got a builder lined up? I mean, do you know
what me.
Are they? Oh, you are literally, yeah,
that's, you and I'm literally and going to be the
heavy machinery.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be the contractor, the builder. My brother-in-law is a framer, so he's a licensed framer, so he's going to be, we'll be framing the house, but I'm lining up, I'm the quote builder contractor, mm-hmm. lining up the, you know, the foundation people, the excavation guy. I'll do all the finish work. I'll do all the painting, all the woodworking, all of the, you know, laying the floor. I'm doing all the flooring, everything like that. The only thing I'm not doing is electrical, plumbing, you know, and drywall. I don't want to, I'm doing that in my daughter's house now. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. That's for an entire house. So I'm fine with, you know, if this takes a little bit longer, I'm fine. I understand. I completely sympathize with everything you went through with losing the house, taking it off. That happened to us back in 2000 when we were looking for a house here. They did the same thing to us. Exact same situation. The housing market was going up and people were, you know, so that they pulled it out from under us and we're like, nothing you can do. I mean, we could have sued them. Our lawyer's like, you can sue them. But he'll just hold you up in court for years and your money will be stuck. Mm. But you want a house. You got kids. You know, in this situation here, I'm knock on wood. Hopefully that doesn't happen again. I don't think it will. The housing market over here is kind of shaky at best just because of the, you know, inflation and interest rates are going up. So prices are going, it's the value of things is actually going down because interest rates are going up. So I don't anticipate this piece of land, and it's a difficult piece of land, and we love it because it is, it's very interesting. It has a nice pond on it, very wooded, hilly area. It's very nice. It's going to be a blast to have, to own, to live with, and manipulate the way we want. But yeah, it's every time, I mean, this is the most expensive home theater project will ever be a part of. Because it really is designed around, the entire thing is designed around the idea of the home theater being in the basement to the point that everybody's like, you really got to have a 9-foot basement? I'm like, yeah, I do.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, you're going to need more material because I can only dig so far down because of the water, right? And they're like, you can only go down this far. So you're going to have I'm like, an 8-foot basement, a 9-foot basement. What's the difference? I'm like, it's a foot. So I got to bring in some more material to cover the sides of that. You know, I got to bring up the ground a little bit more. But they're like, but you could save a little money. I'm like, yeah, but it defeats the whole purpose. Yeah, I'm like, totally. I'm putting this in. I won't get the most expensive paint. All right. I'll save some money there.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you're in the same boat with recording studios because everyone, you know, people walk into houses or into buildings and they just go, oh, this would make a fantastic recording studio. Look at this. This would just be, wouldn't this be perfect? And anyone with any experience walks in there and goes, oh, how high is the ceiling? That's all you want to know. How high is the ceiling? Oh, ceilings. Well, the ceiling's about 9 foot. And you go, don't waste your time. Yeah. Because for acoustically, sort of a rule of thumb, I know you could build a recording studio in any space, but if you want it to be a good recording studio, 12 foot. Wow. You need 12 foot ceilings to make it work because, and again, ties into home theater, because of the amount of space that will get taken up by treatment.
Yep.
You are going to lose feet off it in every single direction.
Yeah.
And, but also to do with, flutter echoes and where you position microphones and reflections off the ceiling and things like that, you kind of need 12 foot. Now, it doesn't mean you can't make a perfectly serviceable recording studio in a smaller space, like 9 foot, 8 or 9 foot, but
everybody's going to play their instruments on their knees.
Yeah, it's kind of, well, certainly with 8 foot. Yeah, exactly. But you can't, building a recording studio, as soon as you start fitting it out with room inside or in front, you know, doing a isolated framing inside the space and then doing the floor, doing the treatments, the walls, the lighting, and not to mention all the recording gear, the cabling, all the custom cabling that's all got to be exactly the right length to do the, you know, you're going to spend 6 months to a year of your life installing this recording studio and fitting all this stuff, and you're going to spend tens of thousands of pounds doing it. And then when you're done, it's not going to sound very good because you've only got like a 9 foot ceiling or an 8.5 foot ceiling, you know, and you're like, you know, so you're throwing good money after bad, as they say. Whereas if you, 12 foot. If you've got 12 foot, you're in business. And a lot of recording studios are double height. You know, they've got like a 25 foot ceiling. Really? You know, they're like a vaulted ceiling. Yeah. If you go into Air Lyndhurst in central London, or Abbey Road Studio One, or the big, or, you know, any sort of big orchestral orientated studio, I mean, it'll be enormous. It'll be 30, 40 feet up. Just because those kind of rooms have a sound that you cannot get any other way than just by having the space.
Right.
And, you know, that's, so I'm going down, my ceiling will be 12 foot. I need to go down about 13, 14 feet. It's like, remind me that I said this, because at some point I'll get a quote and then I'll go, maybe I don't need the studio at all. Maybe I'd rather just keep £250,000 and not build this stupid thing. Maybe I'll just be a plasterer or something. I'll just do carpentry.
You could come over here and do my walls.
Yeah, exactly. My ex is a dog walker. And I'm like, maybe I should just walk dogs. You know, I'd quite
enjoy. It's a simple life.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a simple life. Would you now doing this? Kind of a stupid question. I guess I'm hoping the answer is yes, but so you're going to pay £250,000 to build the studio.
Mm.
How long does it take you to recoup that using the studio? And can you? That's a lot.
Well, you've gone and asked the $1 million question, the $250,000 question. Yeah. No, it makes no sense.
Is this a passion project?
Yeah.
Which I completely understand. I get that.
It is. I think it's every musician's and engineer's and producer's dream to have their own studio. And it's a little bit of a necessity these days. Budgets in the music industry are like a fifth of what they were 20 years ago. You know, not that I do much sort of album recording, but you know, if a new band signed to a label, they've got a budget to record their album, it would have been six figures. It would have been £100,000, £150,000, you know.
Yeah.
And now the budgets are like £20,000. So there's sort of no money in it. But on the other hand, that means that if you are going to take on a recording project for someone, you almost can't afford to go into commercial studios to do it anymore. You have to have your own space to work out of. And I think that's what a lot of producers and engineers are finding now. They're having to build a studio at home. They can't afford to use commercial studios anymore because the budgets aren't there to do it. So it's a catch-22. It'll cost a fortune to build your own studio, but if you want to work, you've
got to have your own studio.
Yeah. And there are ways of making, obviously, you know, whether it'll ever pay for itself. I mean, it is an investment. It is a sort of capital, you know, it is an asset.
Right.
It's not like you've just flushed it down the toilet. It's right. You know, the day will come when you need to sell your property and your studio and it's worth something, as long as it's good. But no, it makes no financial sense whatsoever, to be honest. It's the stupidest idea I think I've ever had. You know, I should have listened to myself back in the 80s and just when I was going, Dad, no, stupid idea, building a recording studio. Terrible, terrible way to throw money down the drain. And now I'm doing it.
But if you love it, then, I mean, our theaters are very much the same, if not worse, right? I think they are, because you come into a theater, like a real estate agent come into your house and be like, okay, well, the first thing they'll ask is, can that, like, if I have a riser, can that come out?
Really?
You know, because not everybody wants a theater.
No, sure.
You know, it's like, well, I only want to sell it to somebody that wants the theater.
Yeah, and
you're like, well, it's going to be harder to find. I don't
care. Yeah, right.
And it's like,
it does happen. That happens with a lot of recording studios, actually, a lot of people's project studios, and they go to sell their house or their building or whatever. And you know, also what happened to the house? You had your amazing studio in it. Oh yeah, some guy bought it and ripped it all out. And you go, what? That took you 3 years to build this amazing facility. Oh yeah, well they didn't want it. They wanted a gym. So they just ripped it apart oh my God. You know, it happens. It's the way it goes. But so much of the industry, so much of the music industry now has gone to working from home in project studios and things, that certainly somewhere like London, you would always be able to find someone, you know, someone in the industry who didn't want to build their own house.
That would appreciate it. Right.
Yeah.
That would appreciate everything. Yeah.
Yeah. But
Now, is this probably the last place you'll be? Your last house?
Yes. Almost without a doubt. I'm knocking on it. I'm knocking
this
on
is an audio-only podcast, but if you could have seen his face. He was just...
Oh, dear, what did I do?
You have a great, happy face. Your smile. Mm-hmm. It's a great look, but when I said, is this your last place, your face just went, yes. Like, dead serious. Like, almost like no smile. Like, it was just straight.
I'm never doing this again.
Yeah.
Forget it.
See, I said that when I built this house that I'm in, and I'm saying it for the new one, but at the same time, I mean, I said it before, and it's not true. I built this house thinking this is my last, this is what I wanted to have forever, but I don't foresee anything. There's no reason for me to leave this new house, because this is it. It's like I'm literally building it to have an in-law apartment. My parents will be there. Mm. So worst case scenario, I move to their half and somebody comes and takes the big half. And, you know, when we're older, I don't know, but I'm like, I'm not going anywhere. But yeah, everything I do, I plan on, like, I don't care about resale value because I'm not selling it. Right. And it's like, I'm just doing it for me. And it's like, but there are people that, like, my architect's telling me, he's like, oh, he designs houses for these people that they're not even in the business. They just buy houses every 5 years. Like, we buy cars. And they just buy them, live in them, they build a new house. Wow. And then, like, they have somebody do it for them, but they're like, oh, design me a house. And then they flip their old one, and there's like, and I guess if you do it enough times, you basically live in free because they keep profiting every 5 years.
Yeah. My girlfriend's best friend does literally that, you know, flips houses. Yeah. And she and her husband doesn't get too involved, but, they move every 18 months because they don't kind of rent a flat and then do up a house. They live in the house that they're fixing up, and that's fine if it's just a bit of, you know, a new kitchen and new bathroom carpets and redecorate, but they literally take on massive building projects and live in the house at the same time with two kids. I said to them once, you know, don't you ever, you know, when they just finished this house and it's absolutely beautiful, you know, immaculate show homes, just amazing. We went round there for dinner and I said, don't you ever feel like you just want to stop for a bit and just live in it? Maybe because it's beautiful. Why wouldn't you want to live here? And they go, oh, no. It's up for sale next week. I'm like, but look at it.
Yeah.
It's great. Or why would you want to go and live in? But of course they've made a fortune, and I mean, it's kind of their income. You know, at some point, I guess they will stop doing it, you know, when they've got enough cash and can literally just buy some for pad free. Outright.
Right. Yeah. You just keep going. Exactly. And it's like, well, all right, what this one's paid for.
Yeah.
And it's like, we'll just live here for rent free, you know, mortgage free. See, that's what's funny to me is, like, people, like you said when we were talking earlier, like, how much time I got before I got to write, oh, you're always busy, you're always doing something. But but when you compare it to somebody like that, I feel like I'm like, I have downtime. I get to go into my theater, not as much as I'd like right now, but I do take the time to relax and a little bit. But there are people that do so much more. So I'm like, you know, it's like, I just look at how I could never move that much because I would never be able to enjoy my theater. I'm constantly, you know what I mean? You can't do that. You'd never get your theater built because you'd be busy fixing up the house and then moving on to the next place. Mm. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. I'm saying it's like, it's just a completely different mindset. It's like, I love being at home. I love, like I said earlier, my septic, my well, everything. I love being in that enclosed space. This is my area. I'm going to live here. This is, you know, power goes out, I start the generator and I'm living normal. Right. It's great. I love being self-sufficient like that, but I don't want to bounce around. I like my house. I like my home. I like my family. I want to be just stay put, you know?
Yeah. You end up, you're not building it just to build it. You're building it because you want to use it. And then once you've got it, and the place I'm trying to build, you know, is sort of the dream. Why would I ever go, right, done that. Let's sell it and build another one. No.
The building's the necessity. You want it because you need it. I want it. This is what I need to have. So I need to have it built. Okay. Mm. And it's like in like my situation, it's like, I can't afford to do this. Like I'm doing an HT tours later today. And I was like on the guys, he has some videos. And one of the things at the bottom of the video, there was some comments. And the first comment on this gentleman who built his theater, just like we do, we design it, we build them, we do these things. And the first comment was, show me you make six figures without showing me that you make six figures. And I'm like, I don't make six figures, but all the work I do, and it's like, it
compensates.
Big time. My buddy, he does sprinkler systems, and he's doing a home on Martha's Vineyard, sprinkler systems, fire suppression. Okay. And he's like, he texts me and he goes, it has in the budget for the home, it has a $500,000 allowance for a home theater. And I said to him, and I go, I'm like, hey, that's not that crazy. I go, especially on a multi-million dollar home in Martha's Vineyard. And I mean, this has got multiple homes on the property. It's got a spare house. It's got a house. It's got a guest house. It's got a help house. It's got all of these things on it. I go, $500,000 isn't a lot of money for a theater. And he's like, really? And I was like, the theater I'm building in my house, I said, is going to be over six figures. But that's not what I'm paying. Right. I just know what the labor and what... John had a theater priced out for his house when he wanted to convert a garage. The quote he got was over $80,000. That's no gear. That's that's just to design and build a theater.
Right.
So all the work we do when we build our theaters to have somebody come in and do all of these things, especially around here, it's such a specialty niche thing. That they know they can get the money for it. It's crazy. But it's like, then you add in the gear, and then it's like the gear that I have, I've collected over 30 plus years. Right. And it's like, and the fact that I've been running the same speakers for 30 years means I haven't had to spend money upgrading my speakers. Right. So I put money into other things.
Totally.
And then at the end of it, it's like, when you add up, like, what would it cost for me? You come into this theater here. What would it cost somebody to have exactly what I have right now? You're probably approaching six figures. If you're starting at zero and you need somebody to build you a theater and do all of this and put it all together and everything's done, you know, turnkey theater, that's probably almost six figures.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah, exactly. I was thinking earlier today when I was walking the dog, and I was just thinking, what's this? So when I get on with this stream with DJ, is there going to be a theme, or we're just going to freestyle it? Clearly, we are freestyling. But what suddenly hit me was, because obviously listening to all the other podcasts and forums and the amount of money people are spending, what they're buying, and I'm just thinking, I've never got that kind of money. I would love some of these, you know, who was on the other day talking about their NZ9 and,
Nelson.
Wow. Yeah. Nelson. Yeah. And, I was like, oh, wow. You know, an NZ9 would be amazing, but really, I don't know how I managed to afford my NX7, you know?
Yeah. He's actually, his is an NX9.
NX9. No, you're
NX9.
Right.
Yeah. NX9. Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, even he was saying, you know, there is the NZ9.
His cousin has
the NZ9. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even he with his NX9 was going, oh, I don't know if I could stretch to an NZ9.
Well, he doesn't. It was more of the money. It wasn't the money. It was the upgrade to it. Because he's seen the NZ9, which is laser, and his is the NX9, which is bulb. And he's like, it's nice. And we've talked about it. I don't think we didn't really talk too much about it in the podcast, but we've talked about it privately. And, but he's like, you know, he loved it. His cousin loves it. He's seen it, but it's not like for him, he's like, I don't really need it. The outlay of money to upgrade from the X to the Z. He's like, it's really not there. Not saying the Z isn't a little bit better, but it's not worth that much more money to be like, what, this thing's great. So, and they are for our theaters. That's, I mean, the NX9 thing, it was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Projector. Yeah. Oh. No, I've seen one once, like in a demonstration. Yeah. That was before I had my NX7. And,
that's a great, I would say that from what I've seen, I've never seen either of them in the wild until I saw Nelson's. I've seen demos of a 7, of a 9. But from what I understand, from what I've seen and experienced in other people, the 7 to the 9, depending on your screen size and stuff like that, your image is probably just as good as Nelson's. I would be willing to bet. It's not like night and day. Like you'd be like, oh my God, that's the 9.
Yes, no, totally. And it's, again, that UK versus US difference, our rooms are smaller. Let's face it, unless we are the sort of multimillionaires, most of us live in living rooms that are, the longest dimension is usually about 20 feet. If you've got a 20 foot lot, if one of the dimensions of your living room is 20 feet, that's a big living room. In the UK, where I am right now is, I think 13 by 16. And I have to watch across the short dimension. So the throw distance I can get on my NX7 is not long. So I'm actually limited. I would like a bigger screen. I can't go bigger because I just don't have the throw. But it's fine. It's fine. It's still a lot bigger than my 65 inch OLED, and I can still do everything I want to do. And of course, as you say, don't need the light output, don't need to run it. The whole thing is hot. It's great. And it's a massive step up from what we used to have. So,
That's what Nelson and I talk about a lot. You know the difference too, but we talk about where we came from and how bad it used to be. And it's,
I was laughing at that. Because again, you think, what am I going to talk to DJ about? And then Nelson sort of stole my thunder because he literally went through all this kind of stuff. I thought, and he's now talking about CRT project. That's my conversation.
Let's talk about it because not everybody listens to every single one. And some people are new to it. And it's like, what did you have a CRT?
Yeah, we did. Okay. So, I was talking about my dad for ages. Yeah. So as a little kid, playing with tape machines. The other thing my dad was into as well as hi-fi was photography. And in the 1970s, I don't know whether this was a similar phenomenon in the US, but in the UK in the 1970s, kind of new families with kids. One of the pastimes they used to do was invite their friends over and sit them down and show them their slides of their holiday, their transparencies. So you get a projector. I'm looking at your face and you're going, "They did what?" So you know how you get your prints, transparencies. You get a projector out and a screen and a big screen. You get a screen on a stand and you turn the lights down.
Yep.
And you'd sit there with a little remote control for your projector and it would change. And here's the picture of the hotel.
Yeah.
And here's my grandfather did
the same thing. That look on my face was like, oh my God, we have many, the dogs, we're building houses. We have, oh my God, we have so many similarities.
So it was the most, as a like 7-8 year old, it was the most boring thing. And you'd be stuck there watching hundreds and hundreds of these slides of the holiday, and he's like, oh my God, and the friends are going, that's very nice, what was the food like there? It's very good, actually. It's not better than you'd imagine. And you go, oh God, and any second now there's going to be the picture of me on the beach, isn't there, and there's Paul on the beach, oh God, with a stupid look of my, anyway. But then he's moved up from slides, he started taking his 8mm camera. film camera around, didn't he? And so instead of the slideshow, we had a marginally less boring film show.
Yeah, with no sound.
Super 8.
Did you have sound?
Initially, no, because this would have been the early 70s.
We did the same thing. My grandfather was doing this. We saw, 50s, 60s.
Right.
And we used to watch the old footage, and it was all like that moving really fast, no sound. But and you had
slow
to.
Frame rate.
And you had to, but he had the same idea. Papa, get your videos, and especially when the slides came out, you'd be like,
no,
like the slides, get the moving pictures, Papa, the moving pictures.
Yeah,
neither of them had audio, but
exactly. We did eventually have a camera that recorded audio at the same time. So, for anyone who's listening and doesn't know, on 8mm film, you could have a magnetic stripe down the edge, which was like a 16th of an inch. No, not even a 16th of an inch wide. It was really thin magnetic stripe down the edge of the film. And you could record sound onto that, like a tape machine. Pretty wobbly, bad sound, but it did work. So we had a camera that did that. But we always had a projector that could play back sound, even if we couldn't record sound. So not only could you make your own little 8mm home movies, but this is before VHS and before video cassettes, there were companies where you could buy 8mm prints of commercial movies that had sound on them.
Wow.
And you could go out and the catalog would come through the door and you'd leaf through it and go, oh, look, they've got Some Like It Hot, or they've got Forbidden Planet, or they've got, various generally older movies. So there would be these independent companies would license big name like Hollywood or British movies and release them as 8mm prints that you could watch at home. Now,
so that's the first like home theater. Yeah,
that was the first home theater. And my dad had a couple of Disney cartoons, and then you'd get a little reel, a little like 3.5 minute reel. I don't know what size that was, 50 foot or something. And you'd get 3 minutes of Mickey Mouse or whatever in black and white to show on your projector, and the kids could sit around and laugh at Mickey Mouse, and then you'd get a goofy one out. But you could also buy actual movies. I don't know how many people did. They were very expensive. But he didn't tend to buy those. You know, he just bought a few things to play, mess around with the projector, until 1977. You know what I'm going to say, and I found it.
Oh man.
That is Star Wars in 8mm.
Oh,
an 8mm color sound copy of Star Wars. And I mean, it's not that special because they sold thousands of these. But this was, hang on, let's see if I can see the year. So this is a US company called Ken Films.
Okay.
Who were like the best known for doing all this stuff. But they generally sold like older 50s and 60s movies and things. But and then they had Star Wars. And me and my dad, I bugged my dad for weeks can we get Star Wars? Can we get Star Wars on 8mm? And then one day he bought it. And here it is. So
that
400
is
foot,
amazing.
A 400 foot reel of 8mm film, Star Wars. Now, you might be thinking, hang on, how'd you get a whole film onto 400 feet of, and
right.
You can't. So this runs for 18 minutes. It's Star Wars in 18 minutes. And it's absolutely ludicrous. But I watched this. So whenever my parents used to go out shopping on a Saturday afternoon, while they were out, I'd sneak out, get the projector out, quickly set it up and get it running and point it at a white wall. And I would watch Star Wars over and over and over again.
Well, you could do it in 18 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. I could. Yeah, exactly. You could get through about five times.
It's the entire movie, just in No.
So it's you've got the opening sequence over Tatooine and the Star Destroyer, obviously.
Yeah.
I think the opening crawl is on there. I haven't seen it in a very long time, but there's a bit of R2 and 3PO. Oh, I don't know how it gets from I think there's a bit of Kenobi and Luke talking about the Force and the lightsaber. And before you know it, they're on the Death Star. And so you got Han and Luke and Chewie are running around the Death Star, and that's a great bit. And it's a, you know, and they manage to, and Ben dies, and they rush back onto the ship, and they escape, and then the TIE fighters come after them, and there's the battle with the TIE fighters, and they destroy all the TIE fighters, and they go, we did it, right? And Leia and Chewie hug, and ta-da! That's the end. And you don't get the Death Star sequence. You don't get the X-Wings.
Heavily
It just
edited.
Ends there. Yeah. Yeah, it's what they call, if you look up in the top right, top left corner, it says here, hang on, let's get my face out of it.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't see that. Selected scenes.
Oh.
Selected scenes. Yeah. There was actually another 400-foot reel of Star Wars, of the first film, from Ken Films again, which had some of the missing bits. So it had the Death Star battle.
So you're up to 36 minutes.
Yeah, you could watch a half-hour-long version of Star Wars if you watched them sort of. But you'd have to edit them.
You'd have to crop them together
because you've got bits that are missing out. Oh, but man,
that's you send me some pictures of that, because that'll definitely go on. It'll be, send me some pictures, and they're in the, they're on the website, which will be in the show notes. So for people listening to this, they're going to be like, what are we talking about? But like, you've got to see these. And I'm going to screen grab a image of you holding it up too, because it looks, it's awesome.
Great, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, and this was,
never seen that. Never heard of that. That's
awesome. If you Google it, Google Ken Films. Ken
I'm afraid to, because they'll probably sell me one.
But they only, as I say, normally Ken Films were all like old 60s classics and, you know, I don't know, probably not even Lawrence of Arabia. And then suddenly they did Star Wars. And obviously they sold hundreds of thousands of these. And then they also did Alien. They did Alien on 8mm, again, as a digest, as a shortened version. And then they went out of business because VHS came along.
Oh.
And eventually, you know, pre-recorded movies on VHS became a thing. And the whole, there were still 8mm film collectors around. And but the market, you know, it was a small market that suddenly shrank to a fraction of its size. And Ken Films went out of business, and that was pretty much, about 81, I think, Ken Films sort of folded. But I do remember leafing through their little black and white catalog they used to post out, going, oh, I'd love to have that. And some movies did come on multiple 400-foot reels. So because most projectors, most 8mm projectors couldn't take a reel bigger than 7-inch, which would be 400. So you'd have to do all these reel changes yourself. You couldn't do what they do in a cinema, which is, you bring all the reels in and then you edit them all together into one giant, you know, you've seen those massive reels like that. Yeah. Yeah. You couldn't do that with 8mm because the projectors couldn't really handle it. But you could buy pretty much the whole of a movie on 8mm, but it would cost you hundreds of pounds. Didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Not the greatest quality, let's face it. So it died out, but that was really the start of me going, ooh, you can watch movies at home. And we were all, our family, or my dad, and you know, was a massive sort of movie fan. You know, my earliest memories again were like being dragged out to the cinema to go and see things, and he was like my movie buddy, really. It's like when none of your other friends wanted to go and see something, I could always go, dad, do you want to go and see? And he'd go, yeah, all right. And we'd take ourselves off to the movies, you know. So it kind of started like that. And because he was so enthusiastic about it, as home cinema became a thing, he started sort of, so we could watch movies on VHS, or, you know, we could get speakers. And so he bought the very first, as I understand it, the very first Dolby Pro Logic decoder, which was made by Lexicon, who I was very familiar with, because Lexicon are a well-known manufacturer of audio gear for recording studios. Mm-hmm. They make the famous digital reverbs that we had in the 1980s.
Okay. I recognize the name big time.
Yeah, and they're still going now, aren't they? Or you can there have been other sort of Lexicon AV processors, haven't there? But they, in the early days, they made a very simple Pro Logic Dolby Surround decoder, which you could use with your stereo hi-fi tracks on a VHS, and get yourself 4-channel left, center, right surround sound.
Yep.
So we did that for a bit with VHS. And then we had Laserdisc, and with Laserdisc came Dolby Digital.
AC3. And so,
excuse me. Yes, you're right. AC3. When it was like RF, it didn't even come out on an optical connection. It was like a special RF connection on the early AC3 compatible Laserdisc players. Yeah.
Yep. You have the specific Laserdisc player to be able to get that. That's right. Yep.
Get that. Yeah. So we had that. But for a long time, we were still just watching things on a television because what was the alternative? And I used to go around the London news agent. There were some London news agents that sold Sound and Vision and the Perfect Vision. Was it TPV, the Perfect Vision? The old home theater magazines.
The Perfect Vision I've never heard of. Sound and Vision I know, and Home Theater magazine I knew.
Right.
Vision, was that just over there?
No, they were all U.S., high-end U.S. magazines.
That one I've never heard of. That's interesting.
I'll see if I've still got any copies around. But so I used to leaf through those going, oh, my God, these cinemas, these theaters are amazing. And, of course, everyone had CRT projectors.
Mm.
So we dabbled with the Sony VW10, which was the first widescreen LCD projector. Which is 576 lines of resolution. So standard def, LCD, but widescreen. And that was about £3,500. So kind of $4,000-$5,000. And it was, by today's standards, it was garbage. At the time, you could point it at a white wall or point it at a screen and you'd get a widescreen image and you'd watch your Laserdiscs or your, that's right. I came back. So I came home from a trip to the US in 98 with a Panasonic A110 DVD player. So that's before DVD was really available in the UK. And I'm like, all right, we're off to the US. I'm bringing back a DVD player and some discs. I brought one of those back and we were off and running. So we had sound, we had projector, we had, and then we just kept upgrading from there. So, I was going, this projector's all right, but I have a feeling CRT would be better. So we picked up a secondhand Barco 8-inch CRT.
Oh.
And then we had two of those. And the last one we had was a Barco 808S, which was an 8-inch CRT projector and was the size of a piano lying on its side. And horrendous. So exactly what Nelson was talking about the other day. Although we were doing it on a budget, if you wanted to go out and buy one of those, they were $40,000 or something.
To buy a new one.
We'd pick up secondhand ones for like £6,000, get it working. And it was exactly what you were saying about, finding a way. It's not, my dad wasn't that well off, he worked as a printer and he was doing okay, but we didn't have the kind of money to splash around, so we're doing everything on a budget. And the heady days of converging a 8-inch CRT, spending a couple of hours trying to make it look good. We couldn't afford a Faruja line doubler.
Right.
But then a familiar name came along, Lumagen came along. And Lumagen made a video processor that could upscale, that could deinterlace and upscale DVD. And we had that Barco 808 running at 720p of 48 hertz. So proper 24 frames a second, double to 48 hertz off region one DVD. Yeah. And we thought we were the business at that stage. That to us at that time was the Holy Grail. And that was late 90s, I guess.
Yeah.
Late 90s or so.
Me and my dad. That was the death of Faruja, though, too. That was it, because we got, once we started getting into more digital stuff and everything, because Faruja was pretty much just for the, like you said, the line doubling. That was the video processing that we had to get. Because, I mean, most of our stuff was like 2-something, right? 280 or something like that. Like LaserDiscs was 480. I want to say like broadcast was like 2 and change. I can't remember the actual numbers.
The problem was that obviously VHS, but LaserDisc and DVD were both based on television standards, broadcast television standards. Mm-hmm. And broadcast television is interlaced, which basically,
not progressive.
yeah, that's right. So it's two fields, two alternating fields.
Right, your odds and your evens, basically.
Exactly. And interlaced worked for broadcast television, but it doesn't represent how film works. So film nuts like us, the Holy Grail was getting from interlaced video to progressive frames of film that represented the image you had on each frame of a piece of film. And that wasn't very easy because film running at 24 frames a second. Sorry, I'm telling you all this. You know all this.
Trust me.
I'm explaining this for the benefit of anyone that doesn't get it.
Oh, I love going over all this again because you're saying stuff that's, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that too.
Yeah, exactly. Because again, if you came into this whole home cinema thing with Blu-ray, you didn't have to go through any of this.
None.
Because the revolution that happened with Blu-ray is that films were stored on the disc at 24 frames a second, which, you know, unless you do some weird processing, is not a frame rate that you can show on an ordinary television because it's slightly too slow. You know, in this country, we're 25 frames a second. In yours, you're 29.97 a second. Don't ask. what everyone calls 30 frames a second.
Right.
And then you've got film that's 24 frames a second. It's sort of incompatible, but there are ways of making film work in broadcast TV frame rates. And one of the ways of doing it is interlacing and 3-2 pull down. Just Google it. 3-2 pull down was the big thing. And so what we were trying to do with LaserDisc and with DVD was go the other way. We were taking stuff that was encoded, interlaced with 3-2 pull down on a region one DVD, and we were going find a piece of technology that could recombine these interlaced fields and produce 24 frames per second video, which I can show on a projector. It won't work on a television, but I can show it on a projector at 48 hertz or maybe 72 hertz, and I've then got film. Low resolution, standard definition, 480 line, but it looks like film. And when you could do that, that was sort of the Holy Grail. And that's what the Farugias did. And but the Faruja would be 20 grand, wouldn't it? $20,000 or thereabouts.
If not more. I thought they were like 40s. 40. Yeah. It was crazy. You'd be, your projector would be, you'd be approaching 100. And then you're going to add on something that was like half the price, right? Yeah. So you spent like 80 on your projector and another 40, 30 or 40 on the processor to make the projector look good. Yeah. And because the content you're putting into it is like a rock. I mean, it's crap.
We were taking garbage and making it look like better garbage.
Right.
Much better, still garbage. But we loved it. We were like, because I think people who are really into home, you know, home theater are just, they are desperately crawling along, trying to get to some ideal, which is looking like the theater, looking like the cinema, presenting film the way film has always looked. And it used to be very difficult and very expensive. And now it's not. Great.
No. Exactly. It's great that we've come so far and the technologies have kind of merged, because like what we went through going from, so we were trying to recreate what we got when we went to the theaters. Okay. So you go to the theater and you have a giant screen. All right. And it's, yes, there's a projector behind you, but that the technology putting that image on the screen is literally doing a frame. So like if you took it's move, that's why it's called, if I don't know if you've seen Babylon yet, but they get into this stuff in that movie. It's I think Paul, you would like
it.
It's very adult, because it's also the behind the scenes and how extravagant the lifestyle is of the actors and stuff. But they really get into, they start at the movie starts in like 1926, I think, or 24, and it's before the advent of sound and pictures, right? So then they move into that. Then they, you get to see, and you'll love that, how they had to mix the sound back then and what it took to get the sound right. It's an amazing scene. But there's a lot of the history, the first 50 years of movie making takes place in this movie. But so basically it's the projector is taking still shots, right? It's 24 frames is 24 still shots. You put them fast enough, they figured out that the eye will blur it to get your brain will see that as a moving image. It's 24 still shots in 1 second, and you'll see it as a moving image. Okay. So that's that. But then you come over to television, they're not doing frames, they're doing lines of resolution.
Yeah.
So it's like, so imagine there's 480 lines on your television from top to bottom, the top being the one, the bottom being the 480th. Interlace means it goes 1, 3, 5, 7 all the way down to the bottom. And then when it comes back to the top, now it's going to do the evens. And they figured out that we could save data rate, we could do this, and the eye won't know the difference, but it actually does, because when we went to 480 progressive, we're still not at frames. We're still not at like movie level where you're getting a full picture on the screen. Now they're just going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 5, and it's scanning the picture down your screen all the way to 480. But because they're not interlacing, they're not leaving out a gap in the middle, it's smoother. It's nicer. And we notice that difference. But today, everything's digital. So the marriage is nice. It's like it's starting digitally and it's ending digitally. So the transformation to the home is easier. Where we had the problem in the 80s and into the 90s, we were taking 480 lines at best, and we're trying to blow that up. And that's where you get into, like, if you get into designing or something, or, you know, you're going to create a poster for a you're going to make a movie poster. You make it huge. It's giant. Mm-hmm. Then you shrink it down and all the flaws go away. But the opposite is true. We have 480 lines of resolutions meant to be on like a 12-inch television. You blow that up to a 100-inch screen, the lines between each line, that those are huge.
Yeah.
Your pixels are, your lines across the top are huge. How do we make that look good?
Yeah,
like without, you've got to sit so far away.
Yes, yeah. Well, and that, and of course, you know, the flat screen television, whether it's LCD or plasma or whatever, did enable, you know, it was more than just, oh, it's a flat panel that just sits, oh, this is much better than CRT. It also enabled different refresh rates. You weren't stuck at 50 hertz and 30, you know, and 60 hertz. And which meant you could throw 24 frame progressive at it and it would just sync to it, you know. So your television would suddenly pop up 24p and it would just display it in 24p. Amazing. But the other thing it did is, because suddenly we had high def, you could now go to 60 inches in size and not go, well, it looks a bit blurry, you know, I prefer the small TV because it was sharper. You know,
right.
I had friends who bought like 20-inch Trinitrons because they were, oh, quality. I know it's small, but the quality is great because it's so sharp. I'm like, yeah, because it's so small.
You're hiding the flaws.
Yeah, you've like condensed the picture down. So all the details are now much smaller. And so you think it's sharper until you sit. I remember back in the 90s, around at my girlfriend's house, and we watched, Al Pacino movie. Not Sense of the
Woman. Scarface?
The one where he's a cook with Michelle Pfeiffer? And he's a cook. He's like in some sort of diner flipping burgers. Oh, what's that called? I'll research it and find it. But we watched that on a 14-inch portable television at a distance of about 22 feet. You know, in her parents' house. The television was in one corner of the room and the sofa was in the opposite corner of the room. And we watched the whole movie like on a postage stamp in the corner. And it's just like, you know, we are now so far away from that, you know, now we have 90-inch, 89-inch flat panel screens, and we're not going, oh, it's a bit blurry. We're actually going, oh, I can actually now see all the detail. You know, it's now up to the television to catch up with the 4K format. You know, we need TVs where you can actually resolve the detail. That's, you know, things have never really been that way around, have they? Where the display technology is actually not as good as the source that you're feeding it. You know?
Yeah, we've always had a better source. Film itself is a better source. I mean, a pristine cut of a film is a better source than, because there is no lines of resolution, right?
Yeah. It's literally a
photo.
I love the idea that we're now buying things on disc and going, it's not very good transfer, is it? You know, this can't be from the camera negative. This is probably from a print or like the interpositive or something, because it's a bit ropey. And you're like, oh my God, you know, in the days of DVD, we'd never have noticed that. We would have been pleased. We were pleased if it was anamorphic and not letterboxed. You know, exactly. That was like, how long have you been waiting for The Abyss? Can you like a decent copy of The Abyss? I feel like I've been waiting my entire life. Since basically The Abyss was one, certainly in this country, was one of the classic Laserdisc demo discs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they had the director's cut extended version and the giant tidal wave. Don't want to spoil the end of the movie, but the giant tidal wave at the end of the film was always the demo sequence that you saw when you go into a shop to check out their CRT projector, and they'd show you that thing off Laserdisc. And so everyone loved that movie, and I think it's a great movie. Ed Harris is amazing in it.
It never came out on
it came out on DVD once, letterboxed, standard definition, and that's the only version that's ever been out. So come on, Cameron, get on with it.
I know. I won that actually on a radio show. I was listening to the radio and they said, be the 10th caller and you can win a copy of The Abyss on a DVD. And I called up and they're like, you're the winner. And I was like, hey, look at that.
Well,
ever since, that is one of those movies, like you said, like imagine it, supposedly it's coming out this month. I heard.
Yes. Is it this month?
March.
Certainly this year.
This year, but I thought it was March.
I haven't, Bill Hunt has been all over it, hasn't he?
Yes.
On the digital bits.
Yeah. You know,
in fact, I've been occasionally emailing Bill Hunt like about every 5 years going, yeah, but where's The Abyss? And he's like, I know.
For him to be able to say
it's actually coming is quite a big deal.
Yeah.
Go
ahead. That's the one that, like you said, spoilers for people. At least two generations of people that haven't seen this movie that'll be like, this is a new one. But like, and especially if how many people haven't seen the special edition, don't know what the entire movie's even about.
No,
because when you see the special edition compared to the theatrical release, The theatrical release, it's a great movie. It's so good that at the end, you don't even question why anything happened. You don't. You're just like, that was a fun adventure because that was the 80s and 90s. You were like, oh, yeah, they went under and there was a thing and then that this happened and that was it.
Yeah.
But there was no meaning to it. There was no, it was just like, it, you know, that stuff happens at the bottom of the ocean. But then when you see the special edition, you're like, oh, there's actually a story here too?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, there's a reason why. Oh, it actually makes sense now. That's odd.
And how powerful is that story in this day and age with everything that's going on?
Oh, God, right now.
Do you see what I mean? Without spoiling it, but do you see what I mean? The way the world is right now, and the way people are talking, it's like, how does that not be like a huge thing right now? Like, why? You'd think there would be a segment of the population dying for this cut.
Instead, that's people have never even seen the film.
They don't know. They have no idea. They have James Cameron in their pocket. They're in their corner.
A lot of people have heard about it, of course, because of the early use of CGI. But whether they've actually sat down and watched the whole film, I don't know whether I've built the abyss up in my head simply because we haven't been able to get our hands on it. But I always loved that. I remember, actually, funny talking about that extended cut, is that the first time I saw the extended cut or any scenes from the extended cut was at a demo of a CRT projector at a home cinema shop. Mm-hmm. And I remember them putting this scene on, one of the end scenes, and me going,
what's that from?
What film is this? They go, oh, this is The Abyss. I'm going, I've seen The Abyss.
I don't remember this.
This didn't happen in the version of The Abyss I saw. No, it's extended. Right. Oh, God. And but only ever available letterboxed. And standard definition resolution was bad enough without chucking a third of it away and just putting black bars up there. You know, very, very strange. But hey, hopefully this year, that'll be a non-issue we can all abyss ourselves out.
that is the bigger
one. To our heart's content.
That is the biggest. I think that is the biggest, in my opinion. I mean, I'd love True Lies, but it's not the end of the world. Mm. That's a fun popcorn movie. I think The Abyss is one that it really just needs to be, if nothing more than, I mean, forget them taking the meaning of the movie out and everything like that. But if nothing more that, like, we all love Terminator 2, and I've heard James Cameron in something, I don't know if it might've been some Abyss, outtakes or part of the special features on the Laserdisc or on the DVD, but that the entire idea was to research for the T2. Like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
From the technology point of view. They just didn't know how to do it, but he knew what he wanted to do. Cause that one's a year before? I think it's 91. That one came out or 90. That came out and Terminator came out in 90. Terminator 2 is in 91 or something.
Years, isn't it?
They're right. Their book ended.
Yeah. 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 Totally. You've seen, you've watched, Light and Magic on Disney Plus.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's what I heard it years and years ago. That I've known that part about the Abyss and the technology and getting ILM to do what they did with the water. Mm-hmm. And they're like, and the idea was I remember him saying like, okay, if we can manipulate water like this, people won't be upset, right? If they make a mistake, that doesn't have to be dead on because nobody's ever seen water do that. So you can't accuse it of being wrong. Right.
Right.
And that was their line of thinking. And then it's like, but now when we go to reproduce that same technology in liquid metal and make a person, okay, now we got to refine it a little bit more because people have seen, how do we transform into a person? How do we, so it was basically the evolution, but he had a path in mind from what I understand.
Yeah.
So,
if ever there was, him and Lucas, if ever there was two directors who've just pushed the technology, Yeah. Every time they've gone out there, it's those two, isn't it? Where Lucas would we have been without them?
Lucas did it twice. He did it with Dolby and Dolby Surround in 77. And then he did it with digital cameras and going everything digital when he rebooted Star Wars in 99 with Phantom Menace. And it was like, he was the one that wanted everything to go digital. And he had been saying it since the 80s that he wanted everything digitally, because then you can, it exactly what we're doing now, the home release, the everything, it makes that whole conversion easier. It makes it editing easier. You just have it right there. It's no more splicing the tapes together. It's just like, bloop, you put it
again. I mean, anyone who has never seen or never had to stop to think about how they edited films when it was purely a film format, and you actually had to cut. Oh my God. I mean, the process you really had to go through to edit a film and produce a whole feature on film was so involved. It's amazing that anyone put up with doing it. But now there are people who just go, oh yeah, I've got Adobe Premiere. You know, I've got Final Cut. I can edit a movie. And yeah, you can, but wow. You know, the way it used to be done is almost unthinkable now. And yet all those great movies that were shot and cut on film, and you don't look at them and go, well, yet it's not very good though, is it? You know, I would have done it differently. You know, I think because now with non-linear editing, you have so many opportunities to change your mind and do it a different way and try it this way and try it this way and just keep changing it. You haven't got to keep cutting film every single time you change your mind about a shot.
Right.
Whereas back then, you're committing yourself, kind of, you know, because you're cutting I've never edited 35mm film, but the editor is cutting a positive, aren't they? They're cutting a print of the camera. So they print, they take the camera negative and they print dailies, and they make like work print. I mean, work prints. I can't remember the term for it, but you make like a one-off positive that the editor can use to cut, because you can't watch a negative on a viewer. So they're cutting the positive, getting it all together, making it work. And then when they go, yeah, I think this works, they then have to conform it. Essentially, you have to go back to the camera negative, the crown jewels, and cut the camera negative to match
cut them.
It on the positive. And then from there, they've got to make a inter-negative. So another, no. Yeah. No, an inter-positive. Yeah. And then from the inter-positive, they've got to make a series of negatives that they can then strike theatrical prints from. And I mean, my God, you know, so important. Whereas, you know, you look at modern films, because you're shooting digitally, they can be still editing the film the night before it's shown in, it gets its premiere. You know, if the director goes, I've just had this idea. Oh my God, why don't we do this? And they can change a scene in the film the night before it's released.
Was it Sonic? I think it was Sonic, where they actually changed it after it was released.
There's been a few films. I mean, changed.
Avengers, it was the voice of somebody Avengers. Or somebody, something like that. They didn't like the way it was like. It was out for a week and they didn't like it. So they just sent them a new digital version and be like, here, we cleaned it up.
Was there, because I didn't.
It was something like that.
I was like, never interested in it. Like, oh, there's a Sonic the Hedgehog movie. Oh,
yeah, yes. I haven't even seen the first one.
There was a trailer, wasn't there? There was a trailer for it that they made quite early on, where the internet, the World Wide Web, was furious because it didn't look like Sonic from the games.
Yep.
And it was something to do with teeth or something. I'm the wrong person to ask.
Yes.
And there was such an outrage about it, they had to go back and redo all the CGI to make him look a bit more acceptable to people.
Yeah.
And apparently it's quite a good film. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
It is really good. I've seen the second one because it is a great home theater experience and people were talking about it. And I was like, all right, I got to check this out. And I even said, I'm like, I don't have to have seen the first one for this, right? It's like, no, you'll get it. And it is, it's pretty good, but it's got some great, great sound in it. The second one.
Right.
So I've never seen the first one.
Very, I mean, it's, you know, it is a double-edged sword because people can make changes so late in a film because you're working digital, you know, does mean that if there are processes down the line that, need to be done, still changing the cut, it's super annoying. I sometimes think it's, because I, you know, I quite like the great film scores, but often if you listen to just the film score of some modern movies, I get the impression sometimes that the composer has written it in order for it to be edited, in that it doesn't flow like a lot of the classic movie film scores did. But it's more like a series of sound effects and stings and drones and things, as if they know that the editor is going to mess with the sequence after they've scored it. So if I make the music sufficiently non-specific and I give them stems, they'll be able to edit my recording to fit the new edit they've done. It's not like I'll have to go back into Abbey Road, get the orchestra back in, and re-record them again, you know, because they changed the edit. There was, which movie was I reading about the other day? Who was it? Had to score and record the whole movie in something like a week and a half because they would not commit to the edit. Oh, what film was it? Oh, that's really going to annoy me. It was Aliens. It was Aliens. James Horner. That's right. James Horner was employed to score it. Oh, that's right. Because I think I should have researched this before bringing it up. But as I remember, I might have this wrong.
Why? I don't.
Go and check it. But they had a previous composer employed to do the score for Aliens, and they were leaving him so little time and not delivering scenes, edited scenes to him to write the score for. He was running out of time because the release date is this date. It is being shown. That's when the premiere is. And they were leaving him so little time to write it. I think he quit. And they brought James Horner in, and James Horner ended up in the same boat, just going, "You're not leaving me any time to score and record this." And in the end, he did it in like just a few days, and I managed to pull it off. But there are tons of bits of it that he's really unhappy with score wise, simply because it was rushed. In fact, there's one section that is literally lifted from a German opera or something. Quite a famous cue in the movie. Is it right at the end? Is it one of the end scenes when
Ripley
are escaping? But you hear this piece of music and you go, "Oh, fabulous piece of music." And it's lifted from almost note from note from an existing piece of music that was out of copyright. And the giveaway is because that piece of music pops up in 2001. So when you watch 2001 now, you sit there and you go, "Hey, I recognize this music. This is the music from Aliens." Uh-oh. And it's not, because it's actually, I can't remember the name of it, but a German opera, like a little sequence from a German opera.
Yes.
And in 2001, it's lifted from the opera. In Aliens, they just copied it. It's right. Note for note.
Wow.
It's mad. But yeah, I mean, you know, and that was, again, that was when they were working on film. Now with digital, they can make revisions at the last, you know, like with 24 hours notice. So although they're not recutting the whole film, there are some films I wish they had recut the whole film before they put it out. But, you know, you know, it's sometimes that amount of flexibility, that ability, the fact that you don't have to commit early on, you can like keep all your options open. Actually, doesn't do people any favors. You know, you might be better off having a good idea and just sticking to it from the start. It's a bit like No Way Home was changing all the way through the film, wasn't it? While they were shooting it, before production started, the script was changing almost like on a weekly basis. Because can we get Toby? Can we get Andrew? Can we, you know? So they're rewriting the story, and it's like, "Well, guys, we're filming in about a week's time. You know, we really ought to decide on the script, shouldn't we? On what happens. And I think it shows. I think it shows there are bits of that film that for me don't really hang together. You know.
See, I wonder if that, like, I get what you're saying, but let me push back a little bit on.
Sorry, I wasn't being very bright side about things then, was I?
No, not at all. But what I'm thinking is, see, in the analog days, you had to shoot things, and then obviously you had to, you know, tape edit things together. You, like, if you shot the end of the movie, you would have to then, you know, you'd have to paste it all together. Whereas if you just shot sequentially, everything would just stay that way. But that's not the way they do that. But I think I go back to when I was growing up, we didn't have computers. I took creative writing, and I would have to write stuff out, and you'd be writing on a piece of paper, and then you'd write, but then you get an idea for an earlier part of the story, but you can't just go and put it in there. You have to write it. And then you'd literally cut your pages and you'd put them much like that. You'd paste everything together. And then when you had to type it all out, you'd have to go and be like, boom, boom, boom. You would type out in order, right? You'd type out what you wrote, but you would have all these place cards to write creatively. All right. A creative story. Right. Then I go to college and I take creative writing, and we have computers and we have a computer lab, and you can go there. And it was like, all of a sudden I'm typing like page 7 of a creative story, and I'm like, oh, I just got a great idea for foreshadowing. Right. I just scroll back. Yeah. I pop into the middle and I say something. It actually fueled the creativity. Because it was easier to do. Whereas 5 years earlier, I'm in high school and I'm like, I got an idea, but I don't want to do all that pasting and stuff. You know, yeah. it would have to be a great idea for you to be able to do that. But now you're going to go and you can manipulate your story so much better. And to the point of, like you're saying about No Way Home, if you had to do everything the way they did 30, 40 years ago, they never would have even attempted to film that movie, right? No. It would have been like, no, we're lock, stock. We're doing this. What if we get Toby? We're done. We're not getting him. Yeah, we're not getting him because we've got our film. We've got our cameras already locked in a position. Yeah. They've got to shoot, right? Yeah. Nowadays, you'd be like, well, throw that out. We'll start new. We just got Toby. Fantastic. Yeah. Right. So it actually fuels your creativity. It fuels the ideas, and I think we're getting better. That's why everything's better now. When you go back and watch older stuff, and it's like, it is amazing when you see a movie like Casablanca or Lawrence of Arabia, and it plays well today. The acting is great. Everything is the cinematography, when it was real, when you actually had to get the shot, because if you didn't get it, you lost it. Not like today, like, we'll shoot at night and make it look like daytime. Okay. Yeah. There's so much more, but most of the stuff back then you watch now, it's like, it's the acting was poor compared to now. Yeah. I mean, we're able to put our efforts into other things. We're able to, it's basically upped the game for everything. And we're the ones sitting at home in our theaters, just sitting at, like, taking in all these different decades of material and just going, wow, okay, that one's just as good, or that one's not as good. Yeah. And it's just, I love the digital stuff. I think it's, I think it's great. I think it's fueling everything.
I think, on balance, I think we're definitely in a better place. You know, it's there are aspects of it that cause some people issues. I know as someone's mixing for TV, it's a sort of similar thing. You've got a deadline, you know, it is broadcast on Friday at 9 p.m. So this is the delivery date and you can't miss it. And then they push you, you know. They're like, oh, we haven't quite finished the edit. Oh, we're just, and the number of times I've been up all night mixing a show that I should have started mixing a week before, but couldn't because been all these delays, and then it just gets dumped on you to catch up the week. You have to do a week's work in like an evening and a half or a day and a half. And it's like, oh, thanks a bunch. And I'm sure that kind of thing happens in film production all the time. But yeah, I think you are right that on balance, you know, the flexibility is definitely a good thing.
Well, it does. And but here's where it balances out, though, to your point, like on balance, like it's fueling creativity and making things easier. And so great material is able to come out a little bit easier, right? But because it's so easy to do, and anybody with Adobe Premiere and an iPhone, we can also produce a lot of crap. There's a lot of bad, like anybody can make a movie nowadays and be like, look at what I did, or look at, I can record, but that's not really right. You know, like somebody like yourself, it's like you'd hear audio. Like I've been learning for 4 years how to get my audio right, but I'm just going off of what I hear. You're the professional. It's like, I'm sure you hear different audio and go, whoa, they did that wrong. That's wrong. They're blowing that out, or this and that, where most people don't notice the difference. But I'm trying to learn how to get there. And I'm trying, and like, you know, it's like somebody like yourself would be like, wow, DJ really screwed that one up.
Oh, God. Oh, boy. No, it's, you know, I mean, yeah, the podcast has sounded great. Has been really good. I mean, there's you know, there are technological hurdles to be overcome. Don't I know? Look how long it took me to get my audio working.
Most people don't hear a difference. Like my son's the one always telling me, like, Dad, most people don't care. Most people don't know. Like 99% of the people don't know the difference. I'm like, but I do. And not only that, it's as I've improved it, people like, I don't know what you've done, but it does sound a little better. Kind of like going from 480i to 480p. I don't know what the difference is, but there's a difference, right? Yeah. And it's like, and we notice those differences. And I know somebody like yourself listening to my podcast is like, when the audio's not right, or our levels aren't right, or I'm blowing somebody out, you'd be like, you notice the difference. Most people would just be like, okay, well, it's just another week.
It's like, but you're with, as a podcaster, as someone particularly doing live streams, you're juggling so hard. There's so much to deal with, and you're doing it all on your own. Whereas if you go to a TV, if you're behind the scenes on a TV production, you know, on a proper television production, you know, there is someone to do every last little job.
Right.
So it's like the whole thing is a massive operation, but each person only has to handle one little fraction of it. And as long as they get their little bit perfect, then the whole thing is perfect. Whereas podcasting, I mean, you know, I've never done this before. You can't see the rig I've got going on in here.
You got your audio is great. What do you use it for, a mic?
It sounds
fantastic.
I am, because as you can see, nothing in front of me.
Yeah, no mic.
I nearly wore a lav mic to do this, but because I got home so late, I really haven't got time to set up all the wireless and all the thing. So I've got a, there's a 416.
Oh, okay.
On a stand, on a big boom, just out of shot. In the proper TV world. Unfortunately, the room's a bit ringy. So
It's not bad at all.
It's a bit. I can hear
you notice it. And it's like, I'm listening. Honestly, earlier on,
it's quite, you know, it's a bit more intimate if I get actually up close to it. But
it sounds closer to like this, right? And it's like,
Exactly.
But I'm like looking at him. I'm like, there's no mic. I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, what is he? I'm like, that can't be off his computer, because you sound fantastic. So, but that's got to be a really nice mic.
Didn't sound so fantastic at the start when I couldn't get any audio working. But
you sounded great. You couldn't hear me.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, that's right. Oh God, PCs just a scramble. You wouldn't believe. Yeah. Again, if I could swing the camera around, you wouldn't believe how much equipment is being used to do this right now.
Well, you got mixers on it and everything?
There's a Yamaha QL1 down here. $8,000 worth. It's not doing very much, to be fair. It's only got this microphone going into it, a little bit of compression, high pass filter on it. And then you're coming back through it. So I'm listening to the output, the mixer, so I can control how loud you are in my ears. And yep. I can also control how loud I am in my ears, but it doesn't change the signal that comes to you. And then that goes into an audio interface, which is connected to the PC.
It's so funny you say that. It's like a lot of people, like I know John and Steve, they can't hear themselves in their ears.
Ah, oh, that's murderous.
Isn't it? Because they never realize when they do this. They don't realize like when the...
They'll get further
away from their mic and they'll be like, that's what's nice. Like when I recorded with my wife, I put headphones on her and she's like, why? We're right here. I was like, trust me, watch. I mean, we were sitting right next to each other in my theater recording that. And I'm like, you put the headphones on, she can hear, I can hear through the headphones. And I'm like, and you'll note it. If you start to talk, you won't hear yourself and you'll be further away from them. And you'll realize it makes you move in better. Were like you on you'll understand it.
Were you on a microphone each or were you both sharing one mic? Oh, nope. Okay. Cool.
I have two of these. I set up the stand. I ran it through the Rodecaster Pro 2, which is fantastic. I mean, it simplifies everything for people like me. It's basically, it's doing everything you've got set up there, but it's a more of a digital.
It's a lot simpler.
Yeah, exactly. It is.
I got to tell you, I did as I was building this rig, because this does. I just grabbed a load of gear and thought, how am I going to do this thing with DJ? And I could do it like this. I could do that. DJ. And as I was building it, I started mentally adding up how much, because this is all work gear.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mind. I don't get a choice. I have to spend money on gear for work because if I haven't got the gear, I can't do the work. But so over the years, and as you were saying, over the years, you pick up this and you pick up that and you gradually, and then suddenly you go, oh my God, I've got so much stuff. How did I end up with all this stuff? Well, I'm the same. So I added up kind of value of the amount of equipment that's going through. It's worth more than my home cinema rig. Even if I include the NX7, this mixing desk costs more than my NX7.
I love that you're bringing this up because I want other listeners, anybody that wants to come off. On. No, not try to show off, but when I'm like, but this is what you do. This is your profession, right?
I've got a bit of a head start, I suppose.
But I get a lot of people are worried, what am I going to sound like when I come on? And that's why I love to get, I've had people on through their phones. I've had people, it's not the audio quality. So I love that. Like I'm running this because people like, I want to sound like him. No, you don't. it's a lot of money. It's like,
You could do as well as this with a USB microphone, pair of headphones and your laptop. And, you're kind of done, you know.
Right.
It's just, trust me, I'm the kind of person who's like, why use £500 piece of gear to do something when I've got a £5,000 piece of gear here that does it just as well, if not better,
just
you know.
The compression you must be running must be.
I set this up so quickly. I can just about see my gain reduction meter from here, but I don't know. I can hear it sounds like in my ears, but it
sounds great because I could just tell. I mean, obviously you've got the boom mic, but you're moving your head and you're moving around, but there's no change in volume, right? So that's your compression. So you're bringing down, like some might be louder if you're getting closer, unless when you got really close to the mic, but you know what I mean? Like where that compression really works. It's like it brings everything together.
Yeah. There's only a tiny bit on it. There's not very much at all. Because nothing worse than things being over compressed. Yeah. You know, just when you really hear it and you start hearing it pumping and said like a true sound guy, you're starting to pick things apart. But you sound fine. Oh, the other thing, while we're talking about it, should mention, of course, I can wander off if I want, because I can still hear you. I can still hear me.
Oh, your wireless headphones too?
I'm on wireless.
Oh, jeez.
So, look at you. Only because I thought I might have to wander off and get something off the DVD shelf behind me. DVD shelf. off the media. Jeez. That's terrible. What do you call it? What do you call a shelf full of
media rack?
Media rack. Okay. Because I was thinking I might have to wander off and grab something and do another little show and tell. And I thought, well, I can't hear DJ. You know, at least this way, if I have to run off and deal with the dog, you can still talk to me.
Yep. Yeah, you can't talk back because once you're outside of mic range. But
yeah. Anyway, yeah. So, yeah.
It's quite the setup you got there. You sound fantastic.
Well, it's not. It's literally. It's as soon as it. As soon as it's. As soon as we're done, it's all coming apart again. You know, because I can't. I can't see my TV. How am I going to watch whatever I'm watching next? Oh boy. Yeah.
So, what are you going to watch next?
Well, next. Okay, so. I think kind of because I'm really bad at watching movies in the
you know what podcast you're on, right? To it.
I never get around to it. This is the problem. I buy a lot of stuff that I really want. That's like, oh, I gotta have it. Oh, that's coming out. It's like, I haven't watched the, you know, the new remaster of Star Trek Motion Picture.
Okay.
And I haven't sat and watched it yet. So I haven't seen that since it came out, since me and my dad went to see it. And so I can't wait to see it.
Really? You've never seen any version of it since then?
When I have, the only other time I saw it was on TV in a hotel room in the US in the mid 80s, you know, where for some reason they showed that long cut, that long TV cut of it. Because I remember me and my dad going, hang on. This, I don't remember. This is much longer than that was the last time I saw it. And I can't wait to see it again. I haven't watched it yet, though. In fact, I'm looking through my 4K shelf up there and just going, I need to watch that. I need to watch that. And about 80% of the stuff I've bought in the last 2 years, I haven't watched yet.
John's like that.
Oh, is he? Yeah.
Yes. John buys, because he'll buy them in bulk at like, you know, Black Friday after Thanksgiving or something, right. And he'll get the he'll go into the sales, and then he'll buy like 30-40 movies, and then in the next year he'll watch like 10 of them. Then he'll do it again the next year, so they keep piling up, and he's like, I own all these movies, but he hadn't seen them.
Kind of the trap I've fallen into is, of course, streaming services and particularly Amazon, because Amazon Prime tends to have a lot of really great movies that I do want to see, don't necessarily want to own, but I do want to see them, and then I might go out and buy them. But of course, they're not on there forever, and you have to keep checking to see when they're coming off. And so a lot of the time I'm going, well, I'd like to watch that disc, but that comes off Amazon in 3 days' time, so I better get that out of the way. So I end up watching a lot of Amazon Prime just to kind of keep up. And I know the stuff is on the shelf. I'll get around to watching it when the time is right. But so what I did do is I caught up with the whole of the Mission Impossible series.
Oh, there you go.
Because I remember I've seen bits of all of them. I'd seen the whole of the first one when it came out. And I remember thinking, you know, all right, bit weird, bit crazy at the end with the helicopter flying down the train tunnel and the whirling helicopter blades. And
you're telling me that can't happen?
Yeah. Just seems a little unrealistic.
Stops, right? Isn't that the one where it stops by his throat or something like that?
Yeah, that's right. It's just ludicrous. But yeah, I mean, it's a good fun film. And so, but I never watched two. And even though two is a John Woo movie, and they're like, hey, John Woo. But I never got around to it because I didn't really like the first one that much. And then I saw bits of the others. So I finally thought with the new Mission Impossible coming out, I really ought to catch up. And I listen to a lot of movie podcasts and the Empire pod. I can highly recommend the Empire Film podcast if anyone's into movies. And they talk about the Mission Impossible series quite a lot. And they're always talking about, oh, yeah, that was a Mission Impossible 3. And of course, I don't know what they're talking about because I haven't seen it. So I finally got around to watching the whole lot. Or at least 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, just in the last couple of weeks on Amazon Prime. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I was really, you know, one is not great, but it's well shot, but it's a bit, the story doesn't, the plot doesn't entirely hold together. So I had big hopes for two. Two was what the heck was going, the slow motion spinning in cars on the edge of the cliff while
that's John Woo.
And I remember thinking, this is kind of typical John Woo. This kind of So, and then 3, 4, 5 are amazing. 3, 4, 5, fantastic. So, and I have Fallout on UHD Blu-ray. So that's next on the list. So Fallout has been sat there for about a year waiting to be watched. But of course, I didn't watch it until I'd seen the other movies. So done that. And the other thing I've been doing again with Amazon Prime is again, I've just been on catch up for the last year or so. I've been mainly trying to catch up with movies I feel like I should have seen, but for one reason or another, just haven't seen them. And then people talk about them all the time and I'm going, oh yeah, thinking, I haven't seen it. Really want to see it. So I finally saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I finally saw Suspiria.
You'd never seen it?
I'd never seen Texas Chainsaw.
From the 70s?
No.
That was 70s, right? Yeah.
Well, funny enough, it doesn't end up on broadcast television very often.
No.
For some reason or other.
I wonder why.
Yeah. So I finally saw that and, you know, ticked that off the list. So the Dario Argento Suspiria that everyone talks about as being one of the great horror movies of that, tick that off. And then fairly recently, I finally saw The Goonies.
Oh, Goonies. You hadn't seen that,
No, I hadn't seen The Goonies.
What'd you think?
I see. Now I'm going to remind you that you asked me there. I didn't offer an opinion, but you could probably read.
Thank you. You probably read
what I was thinking off my face.
I could see. I kind of feel the same way.
I hate to say I couldn't wait for it to end.
I don't feel that bad. I feel like it was because I think if you like it now, it's because you have that nostalgic feeling for it of seeing it when you were a kid. And that's why I wanted to ask you. I'm like, I fully expected your answer to be that, not having ever seen it before, because nobody in their right mind can watch that movie now and go, what? It's literally like we were saying earlier, some movies were made really well. Some movies were made, you could see that was made back in the '80s, and it's just like, but it was for kids and it's a fun movie, but it's not, as an adult, if you've never seen it before, it doesn't play well.
I can imagine being 12 years old and probably every 12-year-old kid that, certainly every 12-year-old boy that saw it probably identified with at least one of the characters and just thought, so he's sort of me. This is great. And just went along with it because it's what you did when you were 10 or 11 years old. You just went on crazy, silly adventures with your school friends. So I can imagine it was great fun when you were 11, not when you've passed 50, probably. Slightly more discerning, but you know, it is what it is. It's fine. I'm glad I've seen it. I don't have to watch it again now. That's good.
See? That was a great response, and it was provoked. You see what I'm saying?
and Ke-Huy Quan. I mean, come on. What a legend. Who played Data? Do I mean Data in The Goonies? Is the Asian kid.
Yeah.
Is Ke-Huy Quan again from... Yeah. From the second Indiana Jones, from Temple of Doom.
I didn't know that was him then too.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So he made Temple of Doom and then got cast in The Goonies and did those two films and then struggled for the next decade to get cast in anything at all. I was shoo-in, wasn't he, for supporting actor the other night?
Yeah.
Had to be. It's like Steve was saying, it just had to be, didn't it? It's just too good a story. And he's great.
It is a great story. I mean, it's funny because you didn't really hear much about him until he won. But you heard, I should say, you didn't hear much about him again. It was like when the movie came out, Everything Everywhere All at Once, when it came out, there were a lot of stories about him coming back and what a great performance it was. There was Oscar talk for him. When did that come out? Like almost a year ago, right?
About it
was
a year
last summer. So there was talk then, But then you, again, kind of like his career, just like the talk about him disappeared. And then when he wins, it's, you're like, oh yeah, there, it's all rejuvenated, which I think is great.
Yeah.
It's, you know,
I actually, when I saw Everything Everywhere, I actually didn't realize it was him. I had no idea. I'd heard how great the movie was, but I hadn't realized.
Yeah. I'd heard it was him before I saw it. Yeah. Right. I'd heard that before I saw it.
I watched it and just went, I don't know who this guy is, but he's great.
Yeah.
I think it's the most moving performance in the whole thing. I'm tearing up just thinking about it. No, genuinely, I thought, yeah, he was absolutely amazing. And then when I realized it was him, I just went, ah, no wonder I recognized the voice. No wonder the voice sort of registered. And he's been cast in something. He's appeared in something else very recently. Actually, it's almost entirely. It is Michelle Yeoh again as well in another. Sorry, my brain's going.
That's how I live.
Yeah. So I think he's I'm made up for him. Is what we.
I was late to that movie too. Steve saw it before I did. A lot of people saw it before I did. I came late to it. But Steve had mentioned to me when he saw it, he's like, Deej, you're going to like this. He goes, this is like right up your alley. Talk about Brightside. And I was like, really? And then watching the movie and then you see the ending and how it plays out, I was like, oh my God. I was like, and it really was. It's you look at it and be like, it's such a great, I think it's such a great message, but great movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of unexpected stuff going on in that movie, and not just the hot dog fingers. I mean, emotionally and it goes to some very interesting places, particularly towards the end.
Yeah,
it's a bit it almost reminds me of. Do you remember if the very first time you saw Back to the Future, and you get through that first 10 minutes of the film, and you end up thinking, these people are awful. They're terrible, terrible people. They're just unbearable. And then it doesn't, and it takes like half of the movie for it to all fall into place and for it to kind of, Everything Everywhere is sort of the same, but round the other way in that half of the film, you think these people are these people.
Right.
And it's not until you get towards the end that it all falls into place and you just go, oh God. Yeah. And you get that sort of punch from a genre film. And everyone, of course, at the time was comparing it to Multiverse of Madness.
Right.
And just going on, there's two multiverse movies. But it couldn't be more different from Multiverse of Madness because of that, because of the emotional
plot.
Yeah, the depth of the whole thing. Yeah. Good film.
Yeah.
Haven't bought it yet.
You haven't bought it yet.
Yeah. I'm like John. I do tend to wait for things to come down from £25 a copy. But you know.
Yeah.
I eventually snap at some point. I'll snap for The Abyss. The Abyss I will buy at sticker price. I don't mind. I'm okay with that.
I know. How you've waited so long, how could you wait longer? Right? It's like, it's out. And you're going to be like, I'm going to wait for a sale. Yeah. We've been waiting over 20 years for this.
Exactly. Yeah. So how are your speakers, by the way? You've got still in their cardboard boxes?
Yes, they are. It's only been a few hours.
Oh, is it?
Since you last heard me. I'm hoping this weekend I will be putting the stands together. I'll be building my stands. I'm getting close. I'm getting antsy. Like even today I was out doing some stuff this morning before we got on and I'm like, all right, maybe I could just make some boxes and have them sit on it because I'm getting antsy and I've got to get it. But I also have to get the wiring done because I have to wire a whole second set of speakers, for 5 channels. To be able to do this appropriately. And I don't want to do that. That's the thing is I don't want to rush this. I don't want to do it like halfway because sometimes when you're doing stuff for fun, like when you get your new speakers for your house, you don't mind just throwing them up and listening to them and doing, but I'm trying to actually give them the, give both sides the same benefit, right? The same shot. I want to hear them appropriately. I don't want to just throw them up and create any false impression either way. Right. So, and I also have to calibrate the room to them. Yeah. So I have to set two different calibrations for each set, you know?
So are you seven channels on your sort of base layer? Are you seven?
I have seven channels for base layer, but I'm only going to be changing out five for the SVSs. Okay.
So you've still got, was it NHTs too?
NHTs in the back will be in the back. Yep. My side surrounds will be SVS. And then if they were to win, if they continue, then I would leave the side surrounds in even for the next set. Cause I think the next set, I'm only doing the front stage. So I'll go with that and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Because I'm not as concerned with the surrounds. It's my front stage. I want to get everything right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the surrounds, I want to have them to be the same. I want, voice and stuff like that, but
yeah,
I'm gonna be playing Star Wars, the opening to that I know so well, and does it pull anything extra? I'm really looking forward to it, but I want to make sure I do it right. I don't want to do anything half-assed and just be like, just to get in there and be like, yay, I heard it, and start tweaking, because I gotta go back and forth with the two of them. So
it's compared to sort of stereo and hi-fi, it's immediately, you're going from two speakers to potentially 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 13 or 14. It isn't, as you say, it's not a throw it up and see what it sounds like. It is a bit of an undertaking, but
Just even if I could just throw the speakers in and then calibrating the room with Odyssey, you're looking at an hour's time just for the running the Odyssey and everything.
Yeah.
And, but now I've got to get the speakers in, get them wired, get everything set, have two different sets of, it's just the logistics of all that is what's kind of slowing me down a little bit, because it's like, so think of what's coming out of my amps is foot to the speakers. I got to wire that to a junction and be able, and then send out wires. So I've got a lot of speaker wire to run. I've got, but I think it's going to be worth it, because I think it's going to be a lot of fun to do. It's going to be in it, and it's an investment of time and energy to get the best set that I can.
Yeah,
get the best.
And this is in your existing theater.
I will be doing in my existing theater, because I know my existing theater so well. I know what I'm expecting to hear, so then I'll be able to. I'll know I don't like the sound of that. I like the sound of that, or I'm getting an improvement here that and I don't anticipate my new room being that much different, because I'm going to run a lot of treatments in my room. It's going to be heavily treated just like this room. So I'm not anticipating a lot of, especially with the higher frequencies, I'm not anticipating a lot of difference. Yeah. I think the room's going to be slightly bigger. This room here is about, 11.5 by, it's about 18, but then I've got filling at the end, front and rear. Mm-hmm. The new one's going to be 14 by 22. And so it's not too much different.
Okay. Yeah. It's kind of the same proportions, just like
slightly
10-15% bigger.
Just a little bit bigger. And it'll have two more subs in it than this one does. But those subs will be able to handle the room. The two I have would be able to handle that room anyways. Yeah. So,
because this is always the challenge, I think, with home theater kit, is that it is such an undertaking when you make a significant change that it's very hard to actually A/B things. To actually go, is this better than what I had before? Is it just different? Or is it, how do I?
Right.
And you know your room so well and spent so much time in there that you'll be quite well placed to go, yeah, this is better. And obviously, if it's significantly better, straight away. There's no sort of, well, maybe it is, maybe it is, I don't know. But when things are really better, it. It just hits you in the face and go, yeah, this is better. But if you actually wanted to be scientific about it and go and be able to say why it's better and check, and you want to A/B things, and it's nearly impossible to A/B home theater right. systems, you know, with a, if you're changing speakers, certainly.
Right. I'm trying to do it as be able to have as quick a change as possible. Like if I can keep it to under a minute, be able to like, all right, take the Marantz, change my, you know, room EQ. Okay. Boom. That's a button. Get up and literally just take the speaker and go ba-doom, 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 and plug in three speakers.
So you are going to try and do that. You are going to try and literally play some stuff, swap things.
And play it again.
Play it again.
Yeah.
Oh, good and for
that,
you.
I can do that. That's the other thing that's nice about the Kaleidoscape. I can set up a script and I can set up some scenes back to back to back to back and have them play.
Oh, great.
So be able to just go hit play, boom, 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 boom. All right. Now switch back, hit play, boom, 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 switch back.
Yeah.
Boom, boom. You know, and it's, if I could, I got to talk to Ara again about the switcher, but I think I might be able to do it remotely as well, even switch speakers remotely. And if I could do that and even without having to get up and just boom, and it took like 20 seconds of, now let's play it again.
Yeah, that's cool. Because I was there earlier this year. I was comparing power amplifiers. What I had to what I just bought. And you quickly run into not only have you got the problem of swapping seven RCA connections. Well, unless you're in a situation where you can set up two power amplifiers side by side, and the speak cables and the RCA cables will all reach both amplifiers. Yeah. And the only other way you can do it is disconnect 14 connections out the back of the amplifier.
Right.
Pull 35, 40 kilos of power amplifier out the bottom of your rack, shove the new power amplifier in, then reconnect 14 connections, and then try and play the same material again. And can you still remember what it sounded like? And it's a real challenge. And the final kicker is, as you say, if you wanted to test it with multiple scenes, if you're playing them from disc, it's the changeover is about 4 minutes between taking one out and getting the other one in, and then it loading and then going through the menus, and if it's night and day different, you will be able to tell.
If it's a minor difference, you're not going to be able to tell.
So I ended up doing it with stereo. I ended up doing it with CD source and just two speakers.
Yeah.
And that was massively, I ended up comparing three different power amps in the end, doing a little shootout for myself between three. And it was fascinating. It's this whole naming no names, but this whole notion of all power amps sound the same.
Yeah. It's not true. If they did, then there would be no other amps. They'd be like, well, then why would anybody?
I suppose there's always snake oil to sell people, you know. It's like, buy this because it's got 600 watts a channel and it's $8,000. So it must sound better. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't.
I've had this theory on some other, and it pertains to power amps. And it also pertains in a funny way where I actually thought about it as like an HDMI cable. And is it possible that all power amps would relatively sound, they should all sound the same. It's just power to the speaker. It's the speaker that should be different. But is there a top quality, and that's where the difference is? It's like the better the machine is doing its job, you're going to have better quality. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. I think so.
It's not that this power amp, they sound different because this one's not doing it as good as this one. And that's why they sound. And much like people say, well, an HDMI cable, there should really be no difference because it's a digital code. And it's like, but how can it be better than another? Well, maybe it's just slightly there's a peak that this cable is capable of. And then there's a minimum that it takes to get through. It will give you the, and then there's a, that's where you get your gradation. And granted, it might be small in that area. I don't know. But I was just thinking, like, because some people say HDMI cables make a difference. Other people saying it's physically impossible. And I'm like, I don't know if that's necessary. I'm not arguing it. I'm just saying, like, is it possible that one just does it so good and the other one's doing it really well, but just not as good? And it's like, you know what I mean? It's like,
I certainly do. Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking with amplifiers. Like, they're just so good, but then the lesser ones, they're just not as clean. Something like that.
In the world of, filling in more gaps in my history. So, in the '80s, I worked in a hi-fi shop. So it comes back to my dad, doesn't it? Every single time.
Always.
So our Saturday afternoons were either spent in a hi-fi shop or in a camera shop. And there were one particular hi-fi shop we used to go to all the time. And we'd spend hours in there listening to stuff. And I ended up working there for a while in the '80s. I was still only like 18 years old. It was just like a Saturday job. And they completely turned my head around about sound and hi-fi and stuff like that. And, you know, back then I used to think speakers were the most important thing, and speakers, you know, better speakers were definitely, you know, the upgrade to go for. But they sold, you know, Linn? Do you know the turntable manufacturer Linn? Mm-hmm. They make a thing called the Linn Sondek. This is in the days before CD that I worked there. Mm-hmm. This shows how old I am. And
I remember those days.
yeah. So there's, you know, so your front end was the best quality front end you had was a turntable. Mm-hmm. And obviously there were cheap turntables and expensive turntables, and surely they all sound the same. And they proved to me, you know, no, it's all about the front end. It's like the sound quality coming out of the speakers can never be better than the sound quality that's going in.
Correct.
You know? So the front end,
that was
the
NHT's,
the most important thing.
That was NHT's pitch. It was like, if these are so neutral, they're so flat, they reproduce exactly what you're supposed to hear. If it sounds bad, it's the source. That's what they used to say.
Yeah. NHTs were used as studio monitors quite a lot. 15 years ago, they were sold and used in studios quite a bit. So they certainly had that reputation. But I slowly discovered working in that hi-fi shop that the tiny intricacies of circuit design and tone arm design and cartridges and all these little analog components, which on the face of it is like some kind of weird, you know, dark science. You know, how is it they're making this cartridge sound better than that cartridge? Why does the arm that the cartridge is bolted to sound, why does that arm change the sound compared to that arm? It's like, this arm is 700 pounds. Why does that sound better than the 400 pound one I was listening to before? I haven't changed anything else. And it was, certainly with analog stuff like power amps and things like that, there are funny details going on in there, choice of components and choice and layout and sort of topology, circuit design, that you can have one circuit that produces 100 watts RMS into 8 ohms and another one that produces 100 watts RMS into 8 ohms. And the second one will sound way better than the first one. And it's just down to circuit design and just how clever the designers are and how good their ears are as well.
It's so, I've used this analogy before. I don't know if I use it on the podcast, but it's like I used to detail cars. Okay. So when you detail a car, it's all about the details. Okay. Anybody can take their car, wash it, and wax it. Okay. Now, why does a car that's just been washed and waxed look dirty next to a car that's been detailed? And now, when I say a detailed, I'm talking, you know, hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars, detailing. What's the difference? Well, here's the difference. When you detail a car, you not only wax it, you set the wax. That's another one, just off the wax. So you rubbing your wax on, and then you take your wax off, you know, Karate Kid, wax on, wax off. That's not it. That's not done. Now you got to, what I used to do is you take, and I still do on my car, is you set that wax. Now you go back and you rebuff it by hand to smooth out that wax, because under a microscope, that wax that you just wiped on and wiped off will have like gradations to it from where your hand has wiped it off. Different depths of wax. Imperceivable to your eye, right? You can't. So why care? Why? Well, I'll get to it. It's details. When you're cleaning the car, you get every nook and cranny, every crack. You go in with a fine brush and you pull out every speck of dust. Every detail is perfectly manicured on that car, so that when you're standing there looking at it, I can't tell what the difference is, but I know that one looks better because your brain, your eyes take in all of those details. You might not recognize the little dust and you might not see the imperfections in the wax, but your brain does. And it's registering that there's a difference there. I don't know what it is. And the same thing holds true with our projectors, with our sound, and with our, I can't tell the difference, but like you were saying, the arm on the turntable, the way it's designed is actually cleaning the sound. It's not cleaning the sound. It's actually putting less noise into the sound that's imperceivable to you. But when you add up everything, if you eliminate enough stuff, it's going to sound that much better.
Yeah.
And then the amplifier is doing the same thing. It's not that one amplifier is better than another. It's that there are amplifiers that aren't as good. They're just not as clean. You know what I mean? Because there's a finite, you know, kind of like you can only get so cold. There's no such thing as below
absolute zero.
Absolute zero. You can't have an absolute negative because it's absolute. Right. It's absolute. But we don't know heat. We don't know the end game because it. Who knows how hot things can get? We don't know yet. But we do know that when all things stop, that's it, zero, right? Well, there's a finite amount that an amplifier can do, but it can also drop down. It can degrade down from there. And that's where the balance is, you know, and it's where do you get, how clean can you make this sound? And like you said, like you're only as good as your source, but everything after that source
is can knock the corners off it.
It's guaranteed to not improve it. It's guaranteed to only degrade it.
Yeah.
Now, what is your weakest link in your chain? And that's what is degrading your source the most in your home theater, in your whatever you have, right? And that's how it works. And and that's what we're doing in home theater. We're constantly trying to improve the links in our chain to not degrade our stuff, the source, as much as we can.
There's an expression in the audio world, sounds like a piece of wire. And that basically means there's an audio component that when set flat, you know, that essentially sounds like a piece of wire. What goes in is what comes out. A 8D converter that you use for recording. And someone can say, oh, it just sounds like a piece of wire. You don't really know. But what they mean is it just went through unmolested, unmangled.
Untouched.
It's just perfect. It's except that it also managed to do whatever that device was meant to do. It managed to do that, and it came out sounding like nothing had happened to it. Sounds like a piece of wire. That's sort of, that's exactly what you're getting at. But there's also the notion of character. And sometimes a piece of equipment has a character, and it's not necessarily better or worse. It's like your argument.
It's a preference. Your
discussion about JVC versus Sony in terms of projection. Some people like the Sony look, some people like the JVC look. So they both have their own character. And so that starts to enter into it. I mean, you know, it's a combination of those two. It's like, I like the character. I like what it's doing to the signal. I like the way it looks. I like the way it sounds. But also I can tell it's not taking anything away. It's not mangling it, distorting the sound.
But
maybe it is. Maybe you like the distortion. I don't know.
Yeah, but speakers are the same way. Speakers have you have your source, which is your, that's your start, right? So that's your piece of content, and then you have your end production, whether it be the speaker or, in like you were saying, or the projector. If but you're never gonna really know the character of the end piece if there's pieces in the middle manipulating it as well. So your goal is to try and get, like, to be able to, for me to be able to judge these speakers, I need to have it in the same chain that I've always had the speakers I'm starting with. Absolutely. Right? If I went to another, my new theater is going to have new speakers, new wires, new everything, new, it's a new environment. My old NHTs aren't going to sound exactly this. You know what I mean? They won't sound the same in that room that they do here, but this is a legit, you know, environment that is the same. I know this, and it's going to, you know, and it, that's the difference. Yeah, and I want to keep everything in the middle exactly the same so I can truly judge the end piece.
Yeah, yeah, it's difficult. In the hi-fi world, we had the concept of system matching, didn't we? Because because you'd have amplifiers that were considered bright, and then you wanted to try to avoid speakers that were also considered bright, because all you're doing is making it extra bright, and you probably didn't want that. So you know, it's like, you could say, yeah, this is a good amplifier, but it won't sound good with those speakers. You should consider these speakers might work better with that amplifier, whereas those speakers you were thinking of before would work better with this amplifier.
But and to me, like, that sounds like one's, that neither of them are neutral.
No,
one's
not
doing something too much, and you're taking two pieces of character and trying to get to neutral.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So one's doing something real, a positive, and another one's doing a negative, not meaning like a bad thing, but I mean like one's, so, and that's getting you back to net neutral. Be like, all right, now that's a nice flat. So if you pair this amplifier with this speaker, this is a bright speaker, but this is a warm amplifier. So
sounds good to me.
You're right back at neutral. Whereas if you just had a neutral amplifier and a neutral speaker, you got the same thing. And then you throw in some EQ. It's like,
You might lose something else down the line as well. It's like, oh, this is neutral and that's neutral. But it's like, there's an old Woody Allen film, isn't there, where there's a scene where it's a classic. It's like an old 1950s horror movie where he's going, so I suddenly realized that if I liked this woman because I had character, and she's, but I just somehow didn't find her attractive. And then there's this other woman who I find, you know, who's devastatingly good looking, but I just don't get on with her. So I suddenly realize, why don't we just put, you know, the brain from this girl into that one, and the brain from this girl into that one. And then I fell in love with the other one. I made the perfect girl. She's beautiful, intelligent, smart, funny. I fell in love with Dolores. it's like you put together what you think is going to be the ideal system.
Right.
And then you sit down and you go, I don't really like it.
Yeah.
It's such a oh man. And some things never change. The hi-fi world was like this, you know, 40 years ago. And we're still doing it now.
And that's the thing. And that's what's funny about watching it on the internet and watching it on social media and watching people like argue over what's best. And it's like nobody has the exact same chain. Nobody has the exact same eyeballs or ears. Yeah. So it's like, it's up to you. Just enjoy what you have. And it's like, and it might not be like, I don't know what set of speakers is going to win this, you know, that's going to be in my theater. But what I do know is it's going to be what I like, and it's going to be what works best in my chain. And that doesn't mean that whatever speakers don't end up in my theater that other people own, it doesn't mean that those speakers are bad. Or that they're making wrong decisions. It's like there's so many variables that it's just go with what you like and don't worry about like everybody else and what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the best sets of speakers I ever owned was old B&W DM601s. £200 a pair.
I used to want B&Ws.
Yeah, I mean these are cheap. affordable BMWs. These are not like the, you know, they,
that's the same.
They were like £100 a speaker, and the center speaker was £200. And I had four of the 601s and the center speaker. And those were blisteringly great speakers if driven by a good front end. If you had a good source and a good amplifier, they sounded absolutely amazing. You know, you can get great results out of budget gear. You just got to listen and choose carefully. And if anything has changed since the days of hi-fi, I feel like the thing that we've lost is demo facilities, the ability to go and scratch your head. You know, and nowadays you go, oh, what shall I buy? Shall I buy the Denon, Marantz, maybe the Yamaha, or maybe Arcam? Maybe I'll splash up by Arcam. So what do? You tend to go on a forum. You tend to go on some home cinema forum and read all the posts, and then you post there yourself going, I can't decide. What do you think? And then you get 20 different answers, and you're supposed to make a decision. In the old days, you'd go to a shop and you'd go and listen to them all. And quite often you'd go in there thinking, I'm almost certainly want to buy that. I think that's going to be what I'll walk out of there with. And then you listen to them and you go, totally change your mind. Because as soon as you heard it, you went, no, I've got to have this. I've got to have that one. It sounded so much better than the thing I thought was going to be best. You know, just being able to demo stuff and let your ears decide what's right for you.
Yep.
It's also probably quicker. It's probably quicker than
sitting
on a forum for a week getting a million different opinions. Yeah. You
know? Especially nowadays, too. Things are the quality of everything is so much better. The competition is so tight now compared to what it used to be. You really can't go wrong. I mean, there's obviously better stuff, but if you found something that you like, that's, you know, you're not wrong, you know, and it's there's it not like it was in the, like you could get stuff in the 80s and 90s that was just like garbage, but it was just all marketing and whatever. And you were happy to do it. But seeing what you hear now, Bose speakers, for instance, it's all marketing. I mean, they're great speakers for what they are, but for home theater, for anything to try and figure out what, I mean, they're not neutral. They're not anything. It's all marketing, and it's all their system too, and how they can recreate in a bad environment. But when you are in a fixed environment, like what we have with home theater, they're not the best system, but that's not what they told you. They said, this is the best, but they don't tell you why.
I was sold out of them. Sort of Sunday supplements over here, you know, it's where you saw most of Bose was in, you know, when you got the magazine that came with your Sunday newspaper, the Sunday Times or whatever, and you'd see a full page ad for Bose Acoustimass.
Yep.
And a lot of people bought them and were very happy with them and enjoyed listening to their music and used to get their friends around and go, look, I've got these little cubes and all the sounds coming out of these little cubes and that box on the floor. And
the bass module.
Yes, exactly. And people were happy, so I'm happy that they were happy. That's great. Yeah. But
what's the frequency response of those? I don't know.
Yeah. Ask me. What's that?
I don't know. They don't tell you.
Listen to what Thriller. Listen to what Thriller sounds like on it. Amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, God, you know, at university, I'm listening to stuff on an AM radio. You know, on AM. Mm. You know, radio stations. Stop me liking music, you know.
No,
sound quality is terrible, but I was still raved about, you know, singles when they came on, you know. So we're spoiled, aren't we, these days?
I think people are. I don't think we are. I mean, we know the difference. I think we've earned where we are. I think I've earned where we are. But yes, people like my son and my kids, my daughter and stuff, they have the benefit. But when they're our age, who knows where I can picture my son and daughter saying the exact same things you're saying about your dad, you know, and being like, my dad was a nut for this stuff and that's why I'm doing it. You know, my dad's motivation was that I didn't get to do this stuff with him. And he's not interested. He took me to the movies. So that's why I love going to the movies.
Right.
But he wasn't, nobody I know likes this like I do. Nobody, you know, this all just came, literally came from me just wanting to do it. And then probably, I guess, ironically, the next person would be John. I already wanted to do it. And then, like we've said on the podcast, John was working at Radio Shack, and it was like, we just started talking about it. And then the two of us kind of just bounced off each other. And, you know, he moved away years later, and then, but we both kept doing it on our own, you know. Right. So that was just it. Yeah.
So how long did you actually lose touch, or did you have to find each other again? Or?
Oh no, we knew where each other was, but it's like our lives, like he got married and then had his first son when we were only 21 years old. Right. And so he had moved down to Texas then. And then we kept touch with each other, but back then touch with each other was like, oh, hey, such and such, like he had family up here and I knew about him. We didn't have iPhone, you know, you didn't have your phones and stuff like you do now. And, if he came up here, I saw him, he had some personal stuff. He came up here for some stuff and I saw him then over the years. But it was years and years between us seeing each other. And then my wife, he opened a comic book store down there, and I really wanted to go down for his grand opening. But I just couldn't make it happen. And again, we hadn't seen each other in years and years, but I knew he was opening a comic book store. I knew that I wanted to go down there for that.
Right.
And then I think a couple, 3 years after he opened his store or something like that, my wife, for my birthday, she gave me a trip to go down and see him. And so the two of us went down there, and I was there for like 4 days, like Thursday to Sunday.
Oh, wow.
And then it was like, we just like when we were in high school again, it's like we got in the car, he picked us up and, you know, or actually we followed him to his house, and we just started talking and we never shut up for the whole weekend. And that was
fantastic.
And a lot of the stuff we were talking about is the stuff we talk about here, and the stuff we were sitting in this, it was kind of a park area, like an amusement park type area. And we're sitting under an umbrella. It was hot. And I think some rain might've been coming in. And, I just said to him, I'm like, you want to do a podcast? I go, this is all we talk about. And it was I came up with Bright Side because of, you know, front of the TV instead of just all the stuff in the back, but then also putting the positive spin. Cause what him and I talked about that whole weekend was just how, like, why are people hating on these movies? I know they're just fun movies, but they're just, let's have fun with it. Why are they're trying to make out, like, you know, these Marvel movies, and they're like, blah, 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 and they're talking to them all like they're Casablanca, and we're like, no, they're not. And we're like, let's just have fun. So that's how it came up. And we were like, let's do a podcast. And so that was in August, and we started podcasting. Our first podcast went out in October, and it took a couple months.
You said that was last year, August.
No, that was
it's been going
2018.
Right.
So we started podcasting. Yeah. We did chat together. Our original podcast was supposed to be a home theater comic book podcast.
Okay.
And he was the comic book guy. I was the home theater guy. And we started off with comics. And then when we, it just by chance, it was like, let's record a podcast. Right. Mm. So, and we were nervous. We didn't know what we were doing. And we're like, okay, I hit record. And we just sat there and we didn't know what to say. We're like, all right, let me hit stop. And it's like, I'd already done all the research on gear, and we had our setups, and we're sitting there and we're doing it, and we didn't know what to do. But just by chance, we started with comics. It wasn't like we're going to start the show with comics and then go into home theater. It was just by chance we started with comics, and then we were supposed to progress into home theater. And we started listening to ourselves, and we're like, this is crap. Like, we can't mix these two. We're like, people are going to be like, what the hell are they talking about?
Yeah, right.
And our first show, we did we had an idea. I won't get into it now, but my son heard the show and he goes, "It sounds like you just put the show on repeat. What happened?" I go, "No, that was we had the segment type thing and it just didn't work. So we just stayed with comics. We're like, let's just focus on this for now."
And you were comics or comic book movies?
Both. Both. Oh, okay. We talk so comics, just, we talk comic right. book movies. Okay. If a movie came out, we had a bunch of different stuff over the years there. We ended up being in a pretty good format, and it's like that I learned that the two of us learned by doing it. And right. it was, I took a lot of that stuff, put it in here. I started this one by myself because John didn't really have the time. He's not like me. You tell me to jump, tell me to jump. I say how high. And John's like, "No, I'll give you a night, Deej. Go easy, buddy." I'm like, "But we could do this." If John was like me, this would be a 7 day a week podcast.
Right.
Because I'd be like, "Let's do this." And he'd be like, "Okay, let's do that." And that's me. But I was like, so I really wanted to do home theater. So a year later, I'm like, "Well, what the hell? I'll just sit here and do it by myself."
Yeah.
And I did. And he came on with me a few times, but he's very good like that, where he knows where to draw the line and I don't. I just keep on going. So then I had to draw the line somewhere, and that's why I had to settle on home theater, and it just made more sense because the chat, the home Brightside chat people, they just weren't as passionate. We had listeners, we had great listeners, but the people here at home theater are just, the two of us would be like, when we'd meet to talk, we'd do to record chat, he'd be like, "Wow," he goes, "the responses you get are like crazy." He goes, "I wish we got those here." And I'm like, "I know, but it's just, there's not as many home theater podcasts, I guess. I don't know."
Yeah.
And, but yeah, so now we're here.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Feel like I do feel like I found my people thanks to Steve, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because it all came about through my frustration with forums and me trying to kind of ban myself from going anywhere near home theater forums because I just found them so frustrating.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was Steve and Danny probably who just said, "Oh, no, the people, you want to talk to DJ, you want to go over the bright side." Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to go, because somehow people suddenly, these other strange home theater people I didn't know started following me on Twitter. And I'm going, and everyone started talking about you and Brightside. And I went, "Oh, okay, I could check that out." Oh, that's probably some other dumb.
What were you podcast. Expecting when you heard that? Like,
oh, no,
no, be honest.
I didn't expect it. No, I'm trying to think. I mean, I know podcasting is very much a sort of homegrown DIY kind of industry, isn't it? And everyone's got a podcast. Anyone can start a podcast. Oh, God. And so my expectations when I check out a new podcast are pretty low. You know, I'm not expecting.
That's my wheelhouse.
That's where we live. And so I listened to the first one or two, just thinking, "Oh, it might be all right. I don't know." And then gradually halfway through the first one.
Like a fungus.
Halfway through the first one, I'm thinking, "Oh, actually, you know what I keep saying, don't I, about your podcast? Because I listen to Brightside and I go, yes, that's me. Yes, you're telling, oh my God, that's exactly what I do. That's exactly, oh, you're so right about it." And, you know, the minute you're having that sort of reaction, you go, "Yeah, this is probably the right place for me, isn't it?"
Yeah.
And it's been fantastic. It's been really, really good. There is a comic book podcast that I listened to, which I had the same reaction to.
Oh,
and
really?
It's mainly Marvel focused. But it is focused on the MCU rather than the books themselves. And that, given a little name check, that's Friends from Work.
Oh, okay.
Work podcast. Yep. Yeah, you'd like that. It's very, and they're not like Marvel fanboys. Like, everything they make is fantastic. They can do no wrong, you know, but they're very honest, but you'd enjoy that. But, I can get my home cinema fix here. It's great.
That's funny.
Yeah, I'm awesome. Finding myself again.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, just meeting you, Paul, is like the conversation we just had. It's like, I can see why you're saying, yeah, that's me. I mean, we are very much alike.
I know. It's frightening, isn't it? Even got the same taste in dogs, for heaven's sake.
I know.
How did that happen?
Yeah. I don't know. It's funny how you find in a lot of we all have so many similarities. Mm. And so, but I mean, we obviously have differences too, but it's all the similarities are just amazing. And it's just like, that's what we concentrate on here is the similarities. Don't worry about the differences.
Although, of course, the live stream, you know, if the three of you are on and everyone's got a different angle on everything. And I appreciate that as well because, you know, as you say, some people love the Goonies.
Yeah.
Some people didn't react to it. So I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the people that love the Goonies. If you love it, you love it.
Right.
And that's why it's important to get a range of opinion. And that's what we get with you guys, you know.
Yeah. That's
what I don't like all the movies that Steve likes, but I love hearing what he thinks about them. It makes me think, you know, maybe I should check it out after all. So yeah. That's good. It's good.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I love about having the three of us is we do all have three distinct like perspectives on this all three of us are very strong in our way, but at the same time, we have a ton of similarities, obviously, but it's like, it brings different, I think it brings a different perspective for the listeners, and different listeners will relate differently. Like, I agree with Steve. I agree with John. I agree with DJ. So it makes us a little bit more diversified in that way. So instead of just me sitting here going, okay, here's a scene that I really liked, you know, and it's like, I think that can get monotonous after a time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So. Also, I mean, you know, I tried to dabble with podcasts some years ago when an audio engineer friend of mine, and we, again, very similar, but same sort of enthusiasm, but slightly different areas we worked in. And I said to him, hey, it's a cliche, isn't it? Hey, we should do a podcast. And he said, nah. He just backed out immediately and saved me years of grief probably by nipping it in the bud like that. So yeah, it was great. I need to ask you, of course.
Okay.
Is that clock in the top left corner right? Have we broken the record?
No, we haven't broken it. You just tied PK. You just tied PK, but I got to go. I've only got like a few minutes, maybe a half hour before I'm recording again.
I'm sorry.
And I still have to prep for that. No, don't.
I don't know who's worse, you or me, because I just started and I'm just.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. I love it. It's like everybody worries when they come on here, there's not going to be enough to talk about. I don't think you had that worry, but a lot of people worry about that.
What do you mean? What are you trying to say?
No. Well, you said you're like, well, no, you knew, I mean, through our emails and stuff. And I mean, I think you knew exactly what you wanted to say. You knew what we would do. But like you said, when you were out walking your dog, you're like, is there a format? Are we going to, you just go, go. I think that's what the best thoughts and ideas come that way. You know, if you try to plan it out, it comes off as too cookie cutter, too rehearsed, you know? And it's like, I like to just go by the seat of my pants.
And it would just be out of character for Brightside, wouldn't it? I mean, you tried it last night.
I know. Exactly. That's the thing. Even that show, the show I do with John and Steve, is a little bit more formulaic, but even that, I got to get out. I'm like, all right, what's next? I like to just go. And, you know, it's tough when it's in a time constraint. That's what's real. Like you said, like last night was really hard for me because I have ideas in my head, but you got to keep them quiet because I know that's just going to be another tangent I want to go on, just like right now.
Well, I had better, I better let you go.
Paul, you can just keep on talking.
I think people, after 3 hours and 24, I think people probably. We'll save it for next time.
There's always next time, Paul.
Next episode. Yeah.
So thank you very much, Paul. It's been an amazing time meeting you. Thank you for reaching out. I know you were a little hesitant at first, or you had a few tweets were like, maybe. And look at you now. You're about to start your own podcast now.
You got the gear, buddy. Let me get this house built first.
There you go. So you and me both. See, we got all that going on. So
exactly.
All right. Thanks everybody for listening. I'll be back on Friday with John and Steve. Thank you, Paul. It's been awesome. And go push play.
Hey, Fred.
This has been a Hey Fred production with theme music by Jeff Bernhardt and Throne Vault Productions.